Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Terry Cota, globally acclaimed entrepreneur, executive, platform software architect, and developer. Now, Terry, you've got this really simply amazing background. You do so much. Thank you for coming in today to do this interview.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. I'm always happy to talk to you.
Now, Terry, can you tell us more about the ACM and the value they provide to business, industry, education, technology, and society?
Well, I'm not sure how familiar users are with the ACM in general. So the ACM is a very interesting organization, particularly compared to other scientific organizations, because of the breadth of roles that it carries out. The ACM is the leading publisher of academic articles in computer science. So if you are a professor of computer science at a university, that's the place where, very frequently at least, your work is going to be published and reviewed by your peers and that type of thing. So that's one of the main scientific roles that the ACM serves. They are this body of knowledge. And of course, because they're publishing this material, they're also collecting it. They are archiving it and making it available through search facilities and that type of thing, through a service that they refer to as the digital library. They're not the only publisher of computer science. The IEEE also publishes computer science articles as well, but they certainly are, if not the largest, one of the largest publishers of that type of material. And there are other scientific societies that are like that. The Chemical Institute of Canada is a scientific body that also does publication of scientific results, obviously in the area of chemistry. What's interesting about the ACM is that they also act as the informal or the de facto body of people representing professional software developers, professional computer scientists, but not necessarily acting in the academic arena. And so this is not normal for scientific society. They don't normally also address kind of the professional side of the field that they're dealing in. So what I mean by that is a person like myself who is not an academic. I do have an academic degree. I have a doctorate in computer science, but I've always worked in industry. I've always worked with startups. And the ACM also tries to act as a body that provides services to those types of people. So they provide mechanisms for professionals to be exposed to what's happening in academic computer science, but also they provide professional development capabilities. And of course, you are intimately familiar with this because you are currently the person who is heading up the ACM's professional development capabilities. So sort of in short, the ACM has these two arms, one in terms of being an academic publisher and the other as being the body representing the profession of computer science in industry. And what's nice is they actually go together in a reasonable way, because obviously what's happening on the academic side, the research that's being done at universities in computer science, is going to have a bearing or an impact on what's happening in the profession. There's a technology transfer that can go on. And as I say, it's not normal for scientific organizations to have both of these arms, and it's an interesting role for the ACM to play, to be trying to assist in that technology transfer operation. So myself, as a person working in industry, working in startups, one of the things that the ACM provides for me is this ability to stay in contact with what's happening on the research side of computer science. In addition, the ACM has a number of programs that are specifically targeted at, and the ACM uses an interesting word for these people, so I may use it again, practitioners. We talk about practitioners. And that there are historical reasons for that as opposed to the sort of more ordinary, perhaps, word of professional. But a practitioner is, for the ACM, somebody who's basically working in industry. So the ACM has a number of programs that are targeted at practitioners or services that are targeted at practitioners. One of the ones that's been around for the longest period of time is Q Magazine. Q Magazine exists not actually as a paper magazine at this point in time, although it did start out that way. It is a digital magazine that's produced on an ongoing basis, and much of the material that appears in that online magazine also appears in print in the communications of the ACM. So anybody who is a member of the ACM receives communications of the ACM, and anybody who has been receiving communications of the ACM for the past 3 or 4 years will have noticed there's actually been a fairly substantial transition in the format and the nature of the material that's inside the communications of the ACM. In particular, there's a practitioner's section inside the CACM now, and the Q magazine, the online magazine, is responsible for producing that printed material. Q magazine is interesting. Again, the ACM publishes a lot of other printed materials. They're not generally referred to as magazines. They're generally referred to as journals. So, you know, they'd be the Journal of Algorithms and all of this type of academic material. ACM is not a journal, the Q is not any journal in that sense, but it is instead an attempt to go out and find out what's happening in the world of the practitioner in professional software development, looking a little bit ahead in time. So what might be happening 6 months from now, or 12 months from now, and 18 months from now, and trying to make people generally aware of those trends and things that are coming on down the pipe. So that's one of the main things that the ACM is providing right now for practitioners, is this attempt to uncover interesting trends that are happening and make people aware of them. Q is also interested in what we call kind of problems. We're interested in looking at those new technologies and not so much just saying, hurrah, here they are, but trying to help the practitioner understand how they're going to integrate into their life and the kinds of difficulties that they might encounter in doing so. So for example, you know, over the past 3 or 4 years, we've seen that solid-state disks have become more and more popular. And solid-state disks have performance characteristics that are quite different from the more physical rotating disks that they're replacing. And so there's all kinds of issues about, well, what impact is this going to have on software development? How aware does the software developer have to be of what's happening with that technology in order to be able to take advantage of it? And so there's been a number of Q articles talking about those things. Some articles have provided very deep background about how the software, the SSD itself functions. So, you know, just right down to the, in some sense, like how they're constructed, you know, what kind of transistors they're built of and how they behave. And then kind of working our way up the stack from that to, you know, how they behave at a software level, and then starting to look at how software may or may not have to be aware that it's talking to an SSD in order to get advantages from the speed increases that they offer. So that's an example of the type of thing that Q offers to the practitioner and therefore the ACM is offering to the practitioner. Another area of publication dedicated or oriented towards the practitioner is our case studies area, where we go and we talk to software developers about very specific projects that they've done. So, for example, right at the moment, we are just trying to put together a case study about big data. And so we're talking to a number of different people who've been involved in specific projects which have involved doing a lot, you know, a lot of processing of large volumes of data using machine learning techniques. And that's kind of typically what's going on in the big data space. So we're right now trying to find a group that have been involved in a project that will be suitable for us to do a case study in. And when we do a case study, we basically sit down with those software developers and have a discussion with them, actually very similar to what you and I are doing right now, in that we have this conversation, we record those conversations, and then we come back and we extract the most interesting components of those discussions, and that becomes the case study that's then published on the website or also becomes incorporated in the communications of the ACM. So, very long answer to a very short question, Stephen.
You know, that's fascinating, just all the kinds of activities that the ACM is involved with. Could you maybe sort of give us some insights as to the roles you have with the ACM and some of the members that you're, or who some of your colleagues are?
So I've been involved as a volunteer with the ACM since about 2000. I was originally, I've actually been a member for a very long time. So I've been a member of the ACM since 1986. When I was doing my master's degree at the University of British Columbia, my supervisor came along to me one day and he said, "Do you know what the ACM is?" And I, of course, said, "I have no idea what the ACM is." And he said, well, there are these people that publish computer science. And you really need to be a member, because that's, if you're going to be an academic, that's what happens. You become a member of the ACM. And so at his behest, I went out and became a member of the ACM and dutifully, you know, started receiving the communications of the ACM and joined some of the special interest groups. So in addition to the ACM as a whole, there are also these more specialized subgroups within it called special interest groups, and they're generally focused on particular topic areas within computer science. So there's a special interest group for graphics, and there's a special interest group for human-computer interaction, and there's a special interest group for operating systems and all of these various types of things. So often you join not only the ACM, but you will join one of these SIGs, and they too publish materials, generally, of course, focused very specifically on the area that they revolve around. And the special interest groups also typically are the ones who put on conferences. So, for example, there is a yearly SIGGRAPH, which is the conference put on by the Special Interest Group for Graphics. And that's one of the premier events in computer graphics throughout all of computer science. It probably has, I think, between 30 and 40,000 people attending it every year. So the ACM, in addition to doing all this publishing, also does all of these conferences. So, as I say, I dutifully joined the ACM, and I started receiving these materials, and I even went to a conference or two, but I never... It was a purely one-way relationship with the ACM in that I received these materials, and I had really no good sense of, you know, who it was, how it functioned, or anything like that. All I knew was that these magazines arrived through the mail that I could then read, and that I got notifications about conferences that I might be interested in going to, and that occasionally I might even go to one of these conferences, and I would see people presenting their work and interact with other computer scientists throughout the world. But as I said, I never even thought deeply about what would be required to make such an organization function. In 2000, I started working for a new startup here in Vancouver called Silicon Chalk, which we've talked about in the past. And one of the founders of Silicon Chalk was a lady named Maria Clave. Maria Clave had been the head of the Department of Computer Science at the time that I was doing my undergraduate degree there. So she was somebody that I knew, and I guess as part of my graduate degree. So she was an individual who I'd interacted with quite a bit at the university. And now we were working with one another in the context of this new startup. And one day she came along to me and she said, the ACM is starting up this new magazine that is going to be focused solely on the needs of, you know, kind of software developers working out in industry. And they need some people to help them. They need some people to help put together this magazine. Would you like to help out with that? And I said, okay. Again, having no idea what that would actually involve. And so I became a volunteer through the ACM through initially working, as I say, with Q Magazine. So one of the roles that I have had since that time, continue to have now, so I've had for a very long time, is I sit on the editorial board for Q Magazine. And the purpose of the editorial board is effectively to find the material that is going to become a part of Q Magazine. Which is interesting because Q Magazine is developed, its material is developed in a way that is totally different than an academic publication at the ACM. Academic publications, professors, people who are academic computer scientists, submit their work. They create these articles, they send them in. And there's a very structured process for that, for their work to be reviewed by other computer scientists, a so-called peer review, which is very common throughout all the sciences as the way of ensuring the quality for the material that goes into the journals. Q, on the other hand, almost never has work submitted to it. Instead, the editorial board tries to, through the collective intelligence of all of its members, understand what's going to be important in those future time horizons that I talked about before. So we're trying to look ahead that 6 to 18 to 24 months and understand what trends are going to be important in computer science. And then again, through the collective personal networking capabilities of the editorial board, we attempt to find people who can write those articles. And we essentially reach out and ask them to write. We tap them on the shoulder and we say, hey, we know that you know a lot about this topic, and we'd really like you to write for Q Magazine. So it's an inversion of the typical publishing process at ACM. Anyhow, the Q board, the Q editorial board, was how I became initially connected to the ACM. Once I'd been working on it for a little bit, I was then asked whether I would like to become a part of their membership services board. And once again, I sort of said, okay, that sounds interesting, without really having any sense of what would be involved here. But that was the start of a journey that led me to interact much more deeply with a lot of people at ACM headquarters, which is in New York, which is where the organization is based and operationally where it exists in some sense. Obviously, it's a worldwide organization in terms of its membership, and it does have some, I believe, smaller offices in some other countries. But the vast bulk of the operational capabilities of the ACM are operated out of the offices in New York City, right, actually in Manhattan. At any rate, so I said that I would volunteer for the Membership Services Board, and I began to learn how the ACM actually did what it does. And it has a number of these boards internally. There is an education board, and there's a professions board. And these boards are all staffed by volunteers like myself, but also with some of the paid staff from the ACM itself. And so the work of the ACM is in some sense always a combined effort by a fairly large set of volunteers and a dedicated set of paid staff members working out of the New York office who actually make sure that everything happens day to day. Because obviously as a volunteer, and again, you know this as well as I do since you're in the same position, we don't have the opportunity to spend full-time on these. This is something that we're doing kind of in the background in addition to our ordinary jobs, our day-to-day jobs. And so there's a lot of just kind of real work that needs to get done on a 24/7 basis to make sure an operation like the ACM continues moving. So as I say, each of these boards is in some sense a partnership between a set of volunteers and paid staff members. And paid staff members are responsible for ensuring that the logistics of everything gets carried out. So, for example, again, if you look at Q Magazine, there is a publisher for that. His name is Jim Maurer. He's a paid staff member of the ACM, and he's really responsible for the mechanics of making sure that the magazine goes out each month. As I say, it's a digital magazine, so he's really responsible for making sure that that material gets up on the website. He's also responsible for coordinating with the editorial board for the CACM magazine to ensure that some of our material, as I said before, appears in the context of CACM. So the ACM has a number of these boards, and I've actually participated in a number of them. So I worked with the Membership Services Board for a number of years. The Membership Services Board was focused around products and services delivered to members that weren't directly related to the academic publishing part of the ACM. So it was a sort of a niche set of services and capabilities. A lot of it was focused around support for ACM chapters. So again, there is this large centralized ACM organization which has members all over the world. But in any specific physical geography, usually a city, groups of computer scientists can get together, or groups of professionals can get together and form an ACM chapter. And again, it's just like kind of a local version of the ACM where those members might get together for monthly meetings or have speakers come in or something like that. So there's a kind of a hierarchical organization in the ACM where you've got a central body and you've also got these kind of local activities going on. And so the Membership Services Board was focused a lot on how those ACM chapters functioned and what kind of services the ACM could provide to help ensure their ongoing life, basically. There is the Education Board, which is responsible for primarily for one of the big things that it's responsible for is creating a standardized curriculum for computer science. So again, if you go to any university in the world and take computer science as an undergraduate, usually, you know, there's a set of things that you're going to have to learn. You're going to have to learn about programming languages, and you're going to have to learn how to program, and you're going to have to learn about machine architecture, and you're going to have to learn about compilers and artificial intelligence. And so, you know, computer science is this incredibly broad field with all kinds of different sorts of information, and if you took any given computer scientist and said to him, okay, well, you know, let's lay out a plan for what an undergraduate should learn over their four-year program, you'd get these wildly different things because, you know, different people have different focuses. So one of the things the ACM tries to do is to put together this model curriculum and say, these are the things that we think any computer science degree should encompass. You should learn some of this and some of this and some of this. And it's a very detailed description going down to the level of there should be a course and should cover this material and that type of stuff. Now, interestingly, the ACM is not a body that has an official capability to sanction a university. So you will not find, for example, that a particular university has, you know, an ACM stamp of approval on its computer science program. But this model curriculum is there for, to help you, to guide universities. It's a resource essentially for them for the ACM to bring together the collective wisdom of a large collection of computer science educators, distill that wisdom down into this model curriculum, and then make it available for everybody. And again, that's part of the way that the ACM functions. It's not a for-profit organization. It's an organization whose, not just motto, but whose mission statement is, and I'll never get it completely correct, but is basically to advance computing as a science and a practice, or as a science and a profession. And generally, anybody inside the ACM really deeply believes that. So a lot of what we do is trying to make things available to other people and make them available freely. It's like we're trying to spread the information about research that's happening. We're trying to spread the information about what's happening in the profession. And we're trying to make these resources available to people to ensure, in this case with the model curriculum, that there is some consistency in computer science programs at different universities, and to ensure that, or to help people create their curriculums by having this, you know, incredible body of work that's been done for them. I mean, the amount of work that goes into developing the model curriculum is astounding, unbelievable. It's hundreds, probably thousands of hours of volunteer effort go into crafting this document and making it available for people. And as I say, it really is, it's the distilled wisdom of the people who are the best in their field. So it's in some sense incredible that we're able to harness all of these volunteers and create these incredible bodies of knowledge and make them available freely to people so that they can use them. So that's another example of, you know, a board at the ACM and the kinds of things that it does. There's the Professions Board, which is a relatively new board. As I said before, when the ACM started, it was primarily oriented towards academics. It began its life as a more typical, I would say, scientific society, and over time has continued to broaden its mission so that it encompasses professional software developers, practitioners as well. And so I'm not sure exactly when, but sometime within the past 5 to 10 years, the Professions Board was created. And so again, this is a board, a collection of volunteers along with some paid staff members from the ACM itself. And the goal of the Professions Board is to try and develop products and services that are specifically of value to the practitioner. In an interesting sort of inversion of the order of creation, Q Magazine was created initially and targeted at practitioners, and the Professions Board came along later And then kind of Q fits inside of it because Q is now one of the things that the practitioners board, the professions board manages effectively. The committee that you worked on, that you mentioned, the professional development committee, is actually a subcommittee of the professions board. So again, you lead a dedicated set of volunteers, and really the set of volunteers, including yourself, who are on the professional development committee, are again an incredibly knowledgeable set of individuals who have put in a huge amount of effort to help make that particular, the results of that particular committee very successful. So the Professions Development Committee is responsible for all of the free courses that are available through ACM. Not actually developing the courses in this case, but, you know, helping to select them and make sure that those courses are going to be valuable for practitioners. Another service that we offer to practitioners is we have joint programs with Safari Books and I believe Books 24/7, which allow ACM members to have access to some portions, at least, of the digital libraries of those companies. And the Professions Development Committee is, in some sense, responsible for those programs as well, again, for helping to make sure that the materials that are delivered are going to be of the best value for practitioners. I can't think of any other ones right at the moment. I guess I mentioned before a case study. So there actually is a case study committee that's responsible for guiding the case study process. And I'm actually the chair of that. So like you are the chair of the professional development committee, I am the chair of the case study committee and essentially responsible for kind of corralling the various volunteers that are on that committee, you know, finding new volunteers when people have to drop off the board, bringing them on. And that committee's purpose is, rather like the Q magazine editorial board, its purpose is to go out and find good things to write case studies about. So our meetings tend to be discussions of, okay, well, you know, what's something that's happening in the industry today? And who do we know? And again, there's a lot of this personal networking involved. Who do we know that would potentially be able to discuss that with us? So again, you know, right at the moment, we are looking at these lightweight JavaScript MVC frameworks because they're becoming very popular. So the most popular of these is a thing called Angular.js, developed by a couple of engineers at Google. Angular.js is becoming very popular in the software development committee community as a way of building what are called these single page applications on the web. These are applications that feel a lot more like desktop applications, have very sophisticated visual interactions, but are still being delivered to you via your browser. We're actually in the process again of talking to a number of people who have adopted Angular.js, used it to build a significant application, and so we're trying to just work out times and stuff where we can sit down and discuss their experiences in building out those applications. So that's an example of the kind of thing that the case study committee does. There are lots of parts of the ACM that I'm not intimately familiar with. So the ACM has about 80 paid staff members, as I say, operating out of their New York offices. And there's a ton of stuff that goes on. So the ACM, either directly through the central organization or through these special interest groups, puts on approximately, I believe, 200 conferences a year on various topics in computer science. And these conferences are, you know, they're incredible things to try and get organized. If you go back to SIGGRAPH, for example, where you've got a conference that 30 or 40,000 people are going to be attending, there's a lot of logistics that has to happen to make one of those things occur. And all of that logistics is basically being handled by those paid staff people back at ACM headquarters. So, you know, they have people at ACM who specialize in, you know, finding and booking venues. You know, how do you find a venue that can hold 30,000 people? I don't have a clue. You know, I work in startups. I work in tiny, you know, collections of people. Dealing with 30,000 people is so far outside of my scope of experience that I wouldn't even know where to start, but they've got people that specialize that. They've got people who specialize in all the kind of communications that has to go around with that, in all of the mechanics of setting up exhibition rooms, because again, a big conference like SIGGRAPH will often also have an exhibits hall associated with it, where companies are coming in and showing off their kind of advances, their tools, their capabilities, and that sort of thing. So again, there's just so much in the way of logistics that's going on. Similarly, you know, we have all of these print publications. The ACM has all of these print publications that they're bringing out. And there's just a lot of pure physical mechanics associated with the process of getting articles, getting them formatted correctly, getting them off to the typesetter, getting them mailed out. And so, you know, there are people who handle all that type of stuff. As I mentioned before, you know, ACM is a membership organization. You can become a member of the ACM. And so there's a whole raft of, you know, people who are just dealing with the process of handling membership applications and receiving dues and, you know, processing that and, you know, support people to help if something's gone wrong. You know, you tried to join this special interest group, but you don't seem to be joined. Why did that happen? So, you know, it's got to have people to answer the phone and help people who are having these types of difficulties. So, I am vaguely aware of these activities happening at the ACM, but they're things that I've never really been directly involved with. So, you know, there really is a huge scope of stuff going on inside the organization.
Now, Terry, you talked about this thing called the Professions Board, which I guess now is called the Practitioner Board. Can you talk about some of the innovations and projects that are coming out of that practitioner board that you believe will be of value to businesses and IT practitioners?
So I don't know that we have any new projects coming out right at the moment that I would say that would blow people away. We're in a phase now where we're sort of, I think, trying to consolidate a number of things that we've done in the past. So, you know, the history with the Professions Board, Practitioners Board, is, as I say, that it actually came into existence after Q Magazine when, in some sense, the ACM realized that there were a broad set of services and capabilities that the organization would need to provide for practitioners, and that Q Magazine wasn't a little isolated instance, but in fact part of a broader set of offerings for those people. And so what's happened is over time, the portfolio of the practitioners board has expanded to include various things. So the ACM has, for example, had these partnerships with Safari and Books 24/7 for quite a period of time, I mean, long before the practitioners board existed. But those programs were clearly targeted for, intended for practitioners. So once the practitioners board had come into existence, they sort of absorbed those things. And for a while, they were being managed directly by the practitioners board itself. And then there came a point in time when, you know, the board said to itself, oh, we're managing a lot of things here, and we actually don't have enough bandwidth to really deal with everything. And so at that point, the professional development committee was spawned and became responsible for managing those things. You have been a particularly active chair for the Professional Development Committee, and you know, you have created new programs yourself, the webinar series, which is really phenomenally successful, is something that came out of the Professional Development Committee under your tenure. So, you know, the Professional Development Committee looked at what they could possibly do, again, to be of service to practitioners, and came up with the idea of those webinars. You have also come out with, like, again, or the committee during your tenure, the idea of the tech packs, the notion of trying to look at all of the materials that the ACM has available on a particular topic and kind of bringing them together into an index or an annotated table of contents so that somebody could learn about a particular topic and then see all of the different things that the ACM had with respect to that. So there are quite a few of these tech packs floating around right at the moment, but the one that I think probably even one of the early ones was on cloud computing. And so the cloud computing tech pack consists of academic computer science articles that have been published about cloud computing, but it also consists of, you know, books that are available through Safari or Books 24/7 and courses. And we haven't talked about this, but the ACM also has partnerships with organizations for online courses. And so that tech pack really tries to bring together all of these capabilities that the ACM has to offer and centralize them around a particular topic to make it easy for somebody to kind of dive in and really learn about something in detail. Similarly, case studies used to be done by the practitioners board itself, we just did them occasionally. They were a particular type of article that we would sometimes do for a Q magazine, but we decided that there was enough interest in them and desirability that we would actually have a separate organization, a separate committee whose only job was to try and go and create those kinds of materials. And so the case study committee was born out of that desire. So there really has been a pretty substantial expansion of the capabilities of the practitioners board or the set of things that it manages over time. And what we're really engaged in now is an attempt to bring some order to all of these things. Because although, you know, we've created them, although we've gone out and we've made these things happen, we haven't always necessarily done a really good job about coordinating them and making them available in a consistent way to the practitioner. So it's sort of it's similar to the idea of the tech packs. ACM publishes a huge amount of information or has a huge amount of information available in a variety of different forms. We have articles published by academic computer scientists. We have articles published by the special interest groups. We have books that are available through Books 24/7, other partnerships. We have webinars that are available. We have courses, online courses that are available. But prior to the tech packs, nobody had ever really tried to organize all of those bodies of information around particular topics. So although all of this information was there, if you wanted to actually find out about cloud computing, it wasn't necessarily easy to do so. It wasn't necessarily easy to kind of walk up to the ACM and say, you know, tell me about cloud computing. And so tech packs were an effort to solve that problem, to make the ACM more accessible to people by orienting it in a way that would match with their expectations or their desires. In a similar way, the practitioners board has all of these different activities happening inside it. We have all of these various services and products and information that are available to the practitioner, but we haven't really done a particularly good job about presenting them in a unified and easy to digest way. So again, if you come to the ACM's website, although you will find a area there about practitioners, it's not particularly easy to delve into that and dig up all of the different ways that we can provide information or that we can help with practitioners. And so we're actually engaged in a process right now, which we refer to as branding, but is really a much more broad attempt to create a unified presentation of how the ACM interacts with practitioners. And we want to make it easy for practitioners to come to the ACM, primarily through the website. I mean, that's our primary vehicle of interacting with people. We want them to be able to come to the website and understand, you know, what the organization is and what it has to offer to them. And that's actually what our big focus is right at the moment, is trying to do that.
Perry, you really demonstrated and spotlighted many of the sort of the gems that are within the ACM, and I guess there is a focal point in the Learning Center at learning.acm.org, where there's all the books and videos that are relevant to the practitioners, those courses that you mentioned, multimedia products, which are videos, podcasts, webcasts, and so on, the tech packs, which you also mentioned. There's a link to the ACMQ content and other resources, and as I mentioned, that's at learning.acm.org. So sort of an attempt to corral all the different kinds of pieces that practitioners would be interested in and finding it in one spot. And the audience members can search for Learning center.acm, or as I mentioned, go to learning.acm.org. Now, you talked about then some of the projects or some of the things that have come out of the practitioner board. Earlier, you talked about the Q editorial board. Are there any upcoming articles or case studies or videos perhaps that may be of interest and maybe give us a bit of a sneak peek that you think would be of value to businesses and IT professionals?
Well, I say in terms of the case study committee, which again, because I chair that, I am most intimately aware of what's happening on its timeline. As I say, we are in the process of developing a case study on big data, so trying to look at a particular application of big data in the context of a company trying to achieve something. And we're also start just at the very beginning stages of developing a case study around these lightweight JavaScript MVC frameworks. I know that we just finished doing the interviews for a case study on software-defined networking, so looking at how there's a change that's happened basically where the control capabilities for network equipment, which have typically been defined by the manufacturer. So you buy a switch from Cisco, for example, or a load balancer, and it does what it does. And it's got lots of configuration options and all kinds of things. But, you know, it's basically Cisco defines what that's going to happen. With software-defined networking, that piece of equipment is exposed as almost a programmable entity on the network. So instead of being something where Cisco has defined what it is, Cisco is providing the piece of equipment, but now the network engineer or the network engineering team is able to go in and define what its function is going to be. And that function can be, in fact, evolved over time, can change dynamically and change to responses of what's actually happening inside the network. And so we had an interview, I'm pretty sure with a couple of folks from Google, where we spoke about some efforts that they have been involved with in using software-defined networking to make their internal networks more efficient. In terms of Q itself, I see a great deal of what the content is going to be because I didn't mention this, but another task of the people who are on the editorial board is to review the articles that come in and make sure that they are, again, up to the standards of Q before they're presented on the board. So I actually don't often read material directly on the website the way that an ordinary person would do because a lot of it I've actually seen ahead of time myself as a result of being engaged in the reviewing process. And the result of this is that I tend to be out of sync with respect to what's going on in terms of the production pipeline. So I know, for example, there is an editorial board meeting this Friday, tomorrow. And I'm actually, you know, flying off to New York this afternoon so that I will be attending that that thing. And I believe that we are going to, one of the topics that we're going to be discussing is some of the changes in database, the NoSQL movement and that type of stuff. But I don't have a good sense, unfortunately, of you know, all the things that we've done in the past and the order that the material is going to come out in. There's typically a gap of about, I would say, 6 months between an editorial board meeting and when the material actually appears for it. So at an editorial board meeting, and these editorial board meetings, we actually sit down face-to-face. That's why I'm flying off to New York, is that we actually have to get together because it's a very dynamic process of trying to work through what these topics are. And we generally also have invited guests who are specialists in that particular area in order to help us out with types of things. And we have found that that kind of very dynamic process is something that is difficult to have happen unless you're face-to-face. It's one of those situations where the technology tools just don't seem to quite provide the level of support necessary to allow the human processes to proceed forward. At any rate, you know, we will sit down on a given night and talk about a topic, and we will work our way through it to try and find out, you know, what's interesting, what's not interesting, you know, what's a solved problem, what's an unsolved problem, where are the areas that practitioners are going to run into difficulties when they try to use these new technologies. And we'll also try to come up with an initial idea of, you know, a set of articles that we would like to write and a set of authors that we would like to write those articles. And following the meeting, there's a process, obviously, of follow-up to actually get all of that to happen. So the publisher of Q, sometimes the guest experts, sometimes other members on the board will reach out and ask potential authors whether they would be willing to write. And then there's a period of time, obviously, where those authors then are creating those articles, actually engaged in the writing process. Then they come back into the editorial board and go through a review process. And then they're able to actually go up on the Q website. And then typically, somewhat later than that, if they have been chosen, will actually appear in printed form in the communications of ACM. So the gap from when a meeting occurs, when an editorial board meeting occurs, to when material actually comes out on the Q website, that's typically around 6 months, and the gap for appearing in CACM might be 9 months to 12 months. And unfortunately, my memory is not good enough to remember what it was we were doing 6 months ago and know what's actually going to pop out the end of the Q over the next little while. So I don't have a good sense of what's coming down the pike in terms of Q, as I say, other than knowing that we're going to be talking about some big data stuff, database related stuff for the editorial board meeting this week.
So we've explored a lot about the different aspects and the value sort of proposition of the ACM and, of course, your role in historically and also currently in sort of many of the key boards within the ACM. Let's now kind of shift gears and talk about your current role. Can you talk more about the company that you're putting a lot of effort in right now and what your role is?
Sure. So I am currently the CTO, the Chief Technology Officer, for a very small startup in Vancouver called Marine Learning Systems. Marine Learning Systems has created a learning management system that is very specifically targeted right at the moment at the marine industry, although we do see some areas where it can be used in other industries as well. So a learning management system, for people who are not familiar with it, is basically a kind of a content management system whose purpose is to, you know, organize and track information about online courses that you're taking. So it provides a vehicle for people to author online courses, to gather together the materials, the content that will form an online course, and arrange it in a way that will be delivered to the student in an online format. Provides a way to author tests, so to enter in questions and you know, the answers for those things, so that you can deliver multiple choice tests at least in an online environment. For recording, you know, the student's progress through the system, so looking at what content they viewed versus, you know, what they haven't, allowing them to take exams or quizzes at various points of time, recording all of the information about that. And so that's what the system is. It's a system that allows people to basically create online courses that are then going to be delivered to students. The founder of Marine Learning Systems, a fellow named Murray Goldberg, who was also responsible for creating one of the very first learning management systems used in academic environments, a product called WebCT, which came out of the University of British Columbia. And so learning management systems have been around in academic environments since you know, the late 90s. That's when Murray came up with WebCT. And they are now completely commonplace in universities and colleges. So it is extremely unlikely that you will go to a university or college and that it will not have a learning management system in place there. And the learning management systems are used in a variety of different ways at universities. So they're used as an adjunct to actual physical courses. So you still might be going to lectures every day, but the learning management system will be used to host lecture notes, course outlines, discussion groups related to the course and that type of thing. It may even have online quizzes and stuff like that to help the student gain mastery over a particular material. an LMS at a university will also be used for delivering pure online courses, so online courses that the university is offering to students for credit. And it may also be used as part of outreach programs at universities for continuing education for professionals and that type of thing. So, as I say, learning management systems have been around for a while and are very, very commonplace now in universities. Out in the workplace, they're not as common. And so in our particular case, we found that in the marine industry, there is a lot of ongoing training happening, obviously. There are, you know, if you're on a ship and you're in the engine room or you're a deck crew or you're somebody, you know, who's operating as an executive of some sort, you know, the captain or whatever, the senior officers of the ship, there is a lot of equipment that you have to be trained on. There are a lot of processes that you have to be trained on. And these things evolve over time. And so in the marine industry, however, this has tended to happen in the past in a more ad hoc way. So a very common pattern, of course, of doing stuff is that people would call job shadowing, or kind of like almost like apprenticeship. It's, you know, if you're going to learn how to do this, then you're going to be paired up with an existing individual who understands how to, you know, whose job it is to carry out those functions. You'll follow him around and learn from him how to do those various things. As everything has evolved to use more technology, it's the type of training and stuff that you want becomes increasingly sophisticated. And so now those industries are starting to feel the need to have more structured, more formal programs for training their employees and providing the background knowledge about various pieces of sophisticated equipment that are in use on a ship. So, for example, ships have now very much switched over to using what are called ECDIS units as part of the way that the ship is navigated. And ECDIS is Electronic Chart and Information System, I think. I can never remember exactly what the acronym stands for. But basically, it's instead of having paper nautical charts, you're now using a piece of equipment that digitally displays this information. And so, whereas we used to train people on how to read charts and that sort of thing, now you need to be trained on the particular piece of ECDIS equipment that's going to be used on your vessel. And so there's a need out there for learning management type systems in industry, and that's the need that we are sort of trying to fulfill. And so some of the things that we do are very much like the learning management systems that are used academically. We let people put content in and we let people take exams and that sort of thing. Part of it, however, is there are unique needs within the industry. So, for example, when you go to university, you take Computer Science 101, you take the same Computer Science 101 as everybody else. There's no notion of the course being customized to you. When you work for a shipping company, on the other hand, there are some things that are in common, so maybe there is a shipping 101 that you take that gives you some background information, but your day-to-day job is typically going to involve very specific pieces of equipment on particular vessels. You're going to work on a particular vessel, and its equipment might not be the same as, you know, the other vessels in that fleet. I mean, shipping companies don't tend to have completely uniform fleets. They have fleets where that have been acquired over time, and so older vessels operate in one way, newer vessels have different types of equipment. And so your job actually is, even though it may be the same, you know, every ship has a captain, every ship has, you know, people who are working in engineering, but the particular pieces of equipment that you're working on may be quite different. And so the training that you need to be, you know, the chief engineer on vessel one may not be the same training that you need to be the chief engineer on vessel two. Some of it is in common, but some of it's going to be very specific to the vessel that you're operating on. So one of the unique aspects of our learning management system is that we understand this. And so when a particular individual sits down to work his way or her way through an online course in our system, we know things about them, you know, because they've signed into the system and because obviously, you know, we have profile information. But we know that they're a chief engineer on this particular vessel, or that they work on these three different vessels, or whatever background information it is. And as they work their way through a particular course, some of the material is in common. So some processes and procedures, or even some pieces of equipment, are going to be standard across the vessels. And so, you know, everybody sees that information. But as they're reading through those processes or whatever, they'll come to particular places in the content where, instead of seeing generic information, they will now see information specifically about their vessel. So they may be reading about a process for fire safety in the engine room, let's say. Okay, there's certain things that are going to be common about those processes across everywhere. You know, what types of fire extinguishers there are, what types of fires there are, what's the appropriate response. But when it gets down to the point of, well, where is this equipment located on your vessel? Obviously, that's going to be very particular to that individual. And so our system can dynamically assemble the content to create customized content for the person who's actually sitting down and looking at it. So they're looking at this lesson on fire safety. We display the common material that everybody is looking at, and then we look at who they are and what roles they play and contextual information, and we say, oh, and by the way, you know, here's where the particular safety equipment is located on your vessel. And here are procedures that are unique to your vessel because of the, you know, particular types of equipment that you're using or whatever. And so from a user perspective, what the user experiences is very customized content. From a content management perspective, I mean, it would obviously be possible to create this experience by building specific content for every individual in the organization. Okay, you know, we know that George here works on this particular vessel, and so, you know, here's the complete set of information. Obviously, that's not tenable. You can't statically create all of this content. So from a content management perspective, what we do is enable people to tag their content in various ways and say, okay, this content or this part of the lesson is common. Everybody sees this. This next part of the lesson, what we need to do is pull in the vessel-specific information on fire suppression equipment in the engine room. And when the content is being developed, then somebody will develop content for that specific subtopic. Okay, I'm developing the content for fire suppression equipment on the Queen of Vancouver or something like that. And they'll write that and tag it that way. And then some, you know, them or somebody else will produce a similar paragraph for every different vessel or different classes of vessels. I mean, there may be five vessels that are all the same. And so those will get lumped together into a single class. And then the system is able to assemble this content into the final lesson for somebody. So that's a pretty unique feature. Again, in a university environment, there's no need for it because everybody is presented with the same information. But in a marine setting where there's all of these different pieces of equipment, there's a need to be able to pull together that kind of information. So that's what we do. That's the software that we're developing, and we've been working at it for about 3 years right now. The initial version of the software was developed very specifically for BC Ferries here in British Columbia, and then we have basically taken the capabilities of that software and built a system that can be customized and delivered over the web for a large number of clients. So, you know, we are now starting to begin communicating with other people in the shipping industry and, you know, finding out that there are a number of people who are interested in using a system like this in order to be able to train their employees. Another thing that's interesting about training in this kind of professional industrial setting is that there's a very large concern with certification and also with, you know, knowledge and skills that cannot be derived from working online. So, for example, you know, if we're going to, you know, teach somebody about fire suppression in the engine room, it's, you know, very good and well to deliver some material to them about this, to say, you know, here are the different types of fires, here's the different types of equipment, here's what it looks like on your vessel. But, you know, as somebody who travels on, you know, BC Ferries, you also want to know that those individuals have actually practiced doing these things. And so the online system can't do that for them, right? It can't help them actually try out different kinds of equipment or try to put out different kinds of fires in a controlled setting. And so clearly a training program at a shipping company like that involves not only knowledge and information, which can be derived from a learning management system like this, but it also involves skills and training, which come from actually being out there in the real world and doing things. But what you want to do, of course, is have the learning management system be able to keep track of these things. You want to know that, you know, George, the chief of engineer down there, has done this particular training. And in some cases, either legally or just through the way that the, you know, the company wants to run, those things actually need to be redone on a periodic basis. So you might actually have to go and recertify yourself in certain types of skills or training on a periodic basis. And so the learning management system wants to be able to keep track of what certifications you have and what certifications you're going to need down in the future. And, interestingly, wants to understand or help employees understand how they can move from one role to another inside of the organization. So somebody who's working, you know, as an engineer on one vessel may, you know, have aspirations to be a chief engineer. And so the learning management system can also help them understand the kind of the skills and knowledge gap that they have in order to be able to perform those things. So we can look at all the courses that we have and the certifications that are required, and we can say, you know what, you're going to have to learn these things and acquire these skills in order to be able to progress through your career. So interestingly, again, unlike a university, in an industrial setting, there's a really direct connection between a learning management system and the way that people progress through their careers. And so that's another interesting aspect of the software that we're working on.
So what technologies then are you employing with this system, and why?
So for probably about the past 10 years, I've been pretty much focused on Microsoft technologies. That came out, in some sense, sort of randomly about 10 years ago. The company that I was involved with, Silicon Chalk, which you and I have actually talked about in the past, was building an application that had to run on laptop computers in educational settings. And at that particular time, the way the market was, essentially all of those laptops were running Windows, and so the kind of most obvious choice of a development environment for building that software was to work inside, kind of the Microsoft set of technologies. And I have been, I've just kind of continued on that path in my career. So at Marine Learning Systems, we are basically still a .NET shop. We use a wide variety of Microsoft products. So we use Visual Studio. We program a lot in C Sharp. We're heavy users of a system called Entity Framework, which is a way that Microsoft has provided of bridging the gap between programming languages and database storage. So it basically presents the database to the programmer in a more object-oriented way. And so we found that to be a very useful tool. We make a lot of use of a technology called LINQ, Language Integrated Query, which provides almost SQL-like syntax for searching over objects, but doing it in the programming language rather than inside the database. So it's an incredibly powerful capability. We use Microsoft's MVC framework for ASP.NET. So, you know, we're building out a web application, so we're delivering pages through MVC. We use some open source tools. So, for example, I'm a big believer in dependency injection, and we use an open source tool called Castle Windsor that does dependency management, dependency injection for us. We have started very recently ourselves, actually, building out a single page application using Angular.js. So we are constructing a relatively sophisticated scheduling system that allows its user to schedule courses, and then also associated with them the resources that they might use, so what classrooms the course is going to be in, what instructors are going to be teaching, and that kind of stuff, and allows that to kind of happen. But again, it's tuned for a corporate industrial setting as opposed to an academic type setting. So that's a quick survey of the kind of technologies that we're using in Marine Learning. learning systems right at the moment.
And what are the top challenges that you're finding at the company, and how are you specifically solving them?
I mean, probably the biggest challenge that we have, of course, is not a technology challenge, but is the challenge that many small companies face. That is, we have a big task in front of us. You know, we've started developing a product from scratch, and so there's just a huge amount of code that needs to be written. And like many startups, there aren't many of us doing it. So, you know, the challenges for us are trying to understand, you know, with laser focus, what it is that our customers really need, and building that for them as quickly as possible. Because, you know, it should be obvious from the description of the learning management system that there is a huge range of possibilities in terms of where we could be spending our time. You know, we could be spending our time developing more sophisticated testing tools, you know, that don't do just multiple choice, but allow people to do free form answers and provide a way for those free form answers to be marked by an instructor, or possibly to be marked automatically through some kind of a system that does text analysis. So that's just an example. You know, that's a little area where there are a number of possibilities that we could implement. And really, there's this gigantic spectrum. There's literally thousands of different features and capabilities that we could add into the system, but we don't have enough people to do them. So we need to be very careful about what it is that we actually build out. We have to know for certain that if we are building something, it's essentially the thing that is going to deliver the most value for the customer, that's going to make the biggest difference to their lives. So that's interesting. So it's not a technology problem. It's a people problem. It's understanding who your customers are, and then being able to translate that into the appropriate technology. Again, like, you know, many startups, funding is always a problem. Any startups are, by their very nature, not profitable enterprises. They're not enterprises that are out there generating profit for the people who own them right now, because you are building the business. You are spending a lot of effort creating the software that you are going to try and sell. So there's this huge amount of, in some sense, upfront investment that's necessary to make a startup function. And you are investing in technology, and you are investing in creating software. You are also investing in things like development of customers and that type of thing. So you are trying to go out and find the people who are going to purchase the software, and you're trying to establish relationships with them so that when you have the software ready, that, you know, you will have a market to deliver it to. So those are the typical challenges of a startup. On the technology side, you know, the challenges, in some sense, you know, they're not quite as hard, but they're definitely there. Part of them is just the constant change that there is inside the technology field. And I've been doing software development since probably 1978. You know, I started off and I was doing not even assembler programming. I was programming the machine at the level of flipping switches and you know, literally putting them directly into memory through a front panel on a computer. So over those past, you know, 30 years or so, technology just changes constantly, and the pace of change is amazing. You know, I've gone from, as I say, literally this point of, you know, flipping switches to, oh, hey, now I can hook up a CRT and a keyboard to my system, and I can do things that way. Oh, hey, I can hook up a storage device to this system, so I can now actually store things out. Oh, hey, I can use an assembler to do this thing, so that now I don't have to work in terms of, you know, hexadecimal machine codes. And, oh, wow, now I can program things in the C programming language instead of assembler. And every year, every 2 years, things change in drastic ways in technology. I don't think that there is any other field like this. There may have been in the past. I mean, you know, not having lived in the past, it's hard to get a sense of what it would have been like to, you know, live through the first years when airplanes were around. Maybe, you know, maybe things changed incredibly quickly for them during that time. But we've been through 30 years where change happens. It's huge change, and it happens on incredibly short timescales, where basically our entire lives are turned upside down, and we have to relearn everything from scratch, it seems. And sometimes there's a sort of a karmic cycle of reinvention to it as well, where we're relearning things or learning new things, but they kind of have a flavor of stuff that we did in the past. So for example, you know, right now, as I mentioned before, we've started to use Angular.js. So we are building one of these so-called single-page web applications based on an MVC framework. And what's happening here is, rather than, you know, constantly going back to the server to have web pages rendered so that you look at a page, you click some buttons on it, then it goes back to the server and another page gets delivered to you and it looks different, has some different content on it, it's got some different buttons on it, it's got some fields you can fill in and you do some stuff and then it goes back to the server again and you get a new page. With these single page applications, everything is being done in terms of JavaScript on the fly on the client. So now what happens is we render some information up on the browser. So again, it's content. We render some text, we render some buttons and things like that. But now, when you push one of those buttons or fill in one of those fields, we're not going back to the server to fetch another page of HTML to be displayed. Instead, that button click or that text field or whatever it is causing some JavaScript to execute on the browser right then and there. And that JavaScript is going to decide what the UI is going to look like. Now, it may have to reach back to the server to get some more data, but there's a really big difference here, which is it's getting data. It's not asking the server to render a page or to deliver UI. It's asking the server just for pure data. So it may say, you know what? The person has clicked on a button here where they want to show a list of customers. So I'm going to reach back to the server and I'm going to ask it for a list of customers. And that list of data, that data is going to come back over the network to me. And the JavaScript code is then going to transform that data into something visible to the user to see. So the JavaScript code is actually responsible for creating the display rather than the server, which is the way that it was kind of older style web applications. Well, obviously, there's a ton of new stuff to learn there. I mean, that's a completely different environment, you know, because in the old style, we were writing C# code, and that C# code was rendering HTML. In the new universe, we're writing JavaScript code, and that JavaScript code is, although rendering HTML, is, you know, doing it in quite a different way. And there's some more deeper fundamental differences between the two, but that just gives you a flavor of how in a very short period of time, the way that we do something has changed in radical ways. And in going back to the sort of the karmic cycle of reinvention that I mentioned, I've been around long enough that I'm looking at this MVC framework and the way that it is rendering the UI all on the browser side, and I'm going, wow, you know, that's actually in many ways similar to the kind of program structure that we had back when we were building desktop applications. There's actually some similarities between those two. And so there's this interesting feel of like, yeah, I kind of did stuff like that in the past, but now there's some new twists on it. You know, back in the old days when it was a desktop application, if I wanted to get data, I could just go read it off the disk and it was pretty snappy. Now, when I want to get that data, like I said, I have to actually reach back across the network to do it, and it's not snappy. And it's failure prone, right? I mean, if the disk fails on your machine, you're pretty much toast. But it's not, of course, uncommon in our network world that you're using some web application and that network connectivity, you know, blips out for a microsecond or a second or two or whatever. And so now you have to deal with all of this stuff. You have to deal with the fact that it's expensive to go back and fetch data from the server. You have to deal with the fact that your attempt to go back and fetch that stuff may fail, and so you may need to try again, or you may need to somehow adjust to the fact that you're going to have to wait for a period of time in order to get that data. And so this is a huge challenge for technology organizations, is that we are just constantly having to learn new things. We're constantly having to adapt in order to provide the best capabilities for our customers. Because one of the things you might say is like, well, you know, you've got some technology, it's working, why not just stay with it? Why not just keep building your application in ASP.NET or whatever? And the answer is, well, you actually get better applications. If you look at one of these single page applications, they actually feel better to the end customer. Their responsiveness is much better. You're able to do things like drag and drop and that kind of stuff more make it feel more like a desktop application, more responsive, more flexibility for the end user. And so, in general, with this technology stuff, you can't sit still. You can't just keep using the same old things that you were using before. You have to adapt in order to be able to deliver the best product to your customers. And so, interesting, I mean, and particularly interesting in the modern day where we've got a lot of open source software floating around. One of the interesting things about open source software is that I think from an engineering perspective, it's often extremely well done. You've got these groups of very dedicated people who are, you know, putting their effort in order to make sure that the technology is as good as possible. They're not often as dedicated about the task of creating documentation. I don't know what your experience with software developers is, but mine is they don't like to write documentation. And so open source software, we got all these brilliant people creating the software. We don't have as many brilliant people creating documentation for it. And so learning open source software packages can be a real challenge. You have to go out and you have to, in some sense, glean the knowledge from out there on the net. You have to find people who are posting about their experiences. You have to find people that you can communicate and interact with. You have to look for examples of things. You have to, in some cases, you know, rely more on source code than documentation. So you find somebody who's put together a little example, and you use that as your basis for doing things. But yeah, learning about technology is challenging, and I think even more so in this age where there's so much open source software, because it doesn't tend to be as cohesively documented as, for example, a package like ASP.NET coming from a vendor who's actually making money from that product, and so in some sense is forced to create a more complete package.
Now, Terry, you've just finished talking about some of the technology choices you've made with MarineLS and why you made them. Can you give some additional software and architecture development recommendations based on your experiences with MarineLS?
I mean, I think that the biggest recommendation that one has for architecture and design is not about specific technologies or specific approaches. The recommendation is to be aware of what I will call the forces at play. I mean, and that's perhaps a way of saying kind of requirements. Every job that I've been, every context that I've been in has had different forces at play, both from the sense of who the customer is, what their expectations are, in terms of the development team that I have had to work with and what their experiences and backgrounds are and their individual kind of motivations in life. So proper software development to me is always a very dynamic process. There is no right answer. The right answer is you have to think about things. You have to understand why you're doing something. So you can't just say, I'm going to do this because I did this before. You have to say, well, okay, what am I actually trying to achieve here? What are my goals? What are the forces that are influencing me? You know, do I have people who want stuff on a particular timeline? How tolerant are those people of particular failures? So for example, if you look at companies that are developing these freemium type applications, so they're applications that are targeted towards a broad range of the consumer market, they're often giving the solution away in order to develop a large user base and then trying to monetize it through some other mechanism. Well, that's a really different environment than MarineLS is, for example, because we're selling software to a much smaller set of clients, and those clients tend to be big. You know, they're shipping companies. They're not your Joe consumer out there on the street wanting to look up restaurant recommendations. And that makes a real difference to the software development processes you choose and the tools that you use. I mean, it has an impact all the way down the line on all of those sorts of things. And again, the people that you have feed into this. I have a collection of developers I work with whose background is all .NET and C#. Well, it would be stupid for me to say we should really be using Java for this, unless there were some extraordinarily compelling reason or compelling capability of Java that, you know, it had that C Sharp didn't have that would make us spend the time to switch over from those things. So you have all of these kind of contextual questions, I think, that come into the software development process. And what I find is, what I see is, there's a tendency in software development circles to be what I would call religious about things. I'm an agile developer. I believe in agile. I believe in Kanban. The people go into circumstances with these beliefs about what is right, and they try to impose them. Kanban is right. I mean, it doesn't matter what's going on. It's obviously the right way for doing things. That's the way we're going to do things. And that's a mistake. So the biggest piece of advice is, there is no right answer. There's only a right answer for the particular situation you're in. And you won't know what the right answer for the situation you're in is until you actually look and understand the situation in detail. And you need to be flexible with stuff. You need to be willing to, in some sense, abandon your firm beliefs and actually look at the context that you're in and evaluate what's going to be most valuable there. So, I mean, I would say, for example, that I'm an advocate of agile development, but I always pick and choose different pieces of it depending on the context that I'm in. You know, I don't necessarily say I'm only going to be Kanban or I'm only going to be Scrum or we're only going to do test-driven development. It's like, look at the situation that you're in and find out what's going to help you achieve your goals most directly. And that's, you know, that's the way that you've got to go.
It's interesting. You're marrying this sort of approach or sort of maybe some ideas, themes, I guess, in software development, software architecture, but you're also tying it to the business side as well and the feedback you're getting from clients and having that kind of constant interchange. If you were to kind of make some recommendations from a business development standpoint, what would they be? You know, based on your experiences of working with startups and working with Marine LS, are there any business development ideas that you think that people should adopt or some themes that they should be aware of?
Again, I mean, I think that this is going to vary from context to context depending on who you're going to be selling your product to and how you think you're going to be selling it. So, I mean, the first part is, again, an open-mindedness about that, even those aspects of your company. Certainly, at Marine LS, I think that we have had some changes in our expectations about who our customers are, how big they're going to be, what type of companies they're going to be. And recently, and you know, I'm not even saying that we know the answer for this for sure right at the moment, but it feels more like it right at the moment based on the kind of the contacts that we're having, that we're going to be dealing with fairly large organizations. We're not going to be dealing with small organizations. And that flavors the way, for example, that we want to present ourselves and the way that we want to price ourselves and those types of things. So from a business development perspective, I guess the underlying principle is, in some sense, the same. It's that you have to develop an understanding of what your market is, who your customer is, you know, what kind of expectations they have about the product that you're trying to sell for them. You have to understand the problem that you're solving. I mean, VCs, venture capitalists, often talk about vitamins versus painkillers as two broad classes of products. So the vitamin product is the one that makes you better at something. It improves things somehow. Often a vitamin might be something that is kind of like a new breakthrough kind of a technology, like a new way of doing things. And vitamin technologies are often cool because they're new. They're spiffy ways of doing things. The interesting and what will happen with your a vitamin type technology is that, you know, you can find out that people are very enthusiastic about it. Wow, that's really interesting. Oh, I didn't know that you could do that. Man, that's I never thought of doing that particular task in that particular way. Vitamin technologies are hard to sell. Because you will find that you will go out and that the people who are actually doing these tasks in a business right now are reluctant to change. Even if there's a better way of doing it, they have a way that they're doing it. They're happy with that way of doing it. It's going to cause them grief and pain in their life to have to do something in a new way. So your vitamin technology better be so much better that that it's going to overcome that resistance that they have to changing things. A painkiller product, on the other hand, is something that, like, it takes away a pain that the customer is experiencing right now every day. And the customer is doing something, and it's like they don't like doing it. And if you can figure out, you know, how you're going to make that better for them, that product sometimes isn't very sexy. It may not be cool, but it'll be really easy to sell. And so those are the kinds of things that you have to understand. What kind of technology am I developing? Am I developing a vitamin, or am I developing a painkiller? And it's going to have an effect on the way that you market yourself, and it's going to have an effect on the way that you sell this, the type of salespeople that you hire for doing these kinds of things. So again, looking at the context that you're in and understanding who you're selling to, what problem you're solving for them, whether there's an existing solution in place. If there are existing solutions in place, you know, what are the price points involved in there? You know, like, what are people paying for solving this problem already? So if you're going to solve it in a different way, again, how is that going to work out for them? So all of these pieces of information feed back into being able to create a successful company. One of the things that I experienced in the past is you sometimes meet software developers, and it's like, they've got this great idea, and it's like, they just know it's going to work. It's like, oh my God, this is the best way of doing X that there's ever been, and I'm going to go out and I'm going to create this product, and it's going to go viral, and it's going to be amazingly successful. And it's all in their head. And that's a good place to start. You know, you have to have innovation. You have to have those people who are thinking up new and exciting ways of doing things. But that's not a business, and it's not a business plan. It's an idea. And in order to make the transition from an idea to a business or a business plan, you actually have to start going out and talking to people. You have to identify who your customer is going to be. And you have to go out and you have to interact with them and find out, okay, I've got this great idea. What actually happens when I try to mesh that great idea with the reality of what is happening in the customers that I think that I'm going to sell this to? And so the advice there is, you've got to get out, and you've got to be on the street, basically. You've got to be out there finding potential customers, talking to potential customers, understanding what's happening in their business and how your idea relates to those things. And when you do those things, you'll have at least the raw information that will help you guide how the rest of your organization should be developed. And I say those pieces of information will interestingly feed back into the technology side of things and in the software development side of things. Some customers, and this is not uncommon in enterprise customers, for example, don't like their software to change on a continual basis. So right now, you can go out and you can read about the wonders of continuous deployment. I've got my software developer, and he's working on this new feature, and he's going to check it in, and we're going to run the tests, and we're going to continuously, and it's going to be on the website tomorrow, and people will be using this feature, and we're just doing this every day, like there's features going out. For consumer-facing websites, that usually works pretty well. You know, people like to see new features. In enterprise environments where people develop kind of set processes for doing stuff, constant change like that is an annoyance often. Not always, but again, you have to know what your customer is doing. But that kind of continuous change of stuff can be really frustrating for people because they're trying to develop these set processes and procedures for doing things, and you keep yanking the rug out from underneath them by making things different. So, you know, continuous deployment, while a really interesting thing and really valuable in some contexts, is not necessarily the right choice for every software company. And how do you know this? You know this by understanding who your customer is and what their needs are.
You know, it's interesting in your discussion, it sort of touches on this, I guess, a fairly amazing revolution that started happening about 10 years ago with Steve Blank and his customer development, followed by Eric Ries and Lean Startup. And then you have Alexander Osterwalder with the, you know, the business model generation, business model canvas. It sounds like here you've got all of these years of experience, and then it's being sort of encapsulated in these three, you know, entrepreneurs and authors and so on, and instead of sweeping Silicon Valley and migrating to other parts of the world. And I can see a lot of the elements that you're talking about based on all of your experiences being captured in the books and lectures and courses and so on that these three people have put out.
Yeah, it's certainly true. I mean, I very much enjoy Steve Blank's writings. I follow along his blog and stuff like that. But even so, as I say, I will find occasionally things that they say. I'll go, you know what? That's not right for me and where I am right now. So, again, despite the fact that there are many good ideas out there and that there are people like Steve Blank who are very good at explaining them and presenting them, there's always still a context. And that context is going to inform your choices. And the skill or the talent that you need is to recognize when your context matches up with what they're describing. Because the one problem with people like that is that there's a tendency towards believing that they've done something that covers off every situation. And that's rare, if not non-existent, in my experience.
Well, we're now going to switch gears a bit, and it's going to go back to this idea of your Microsoft experiences. And, I mean, you're really one of the most notable software developers and using Microsoft technologies in the world. And so we're going to mine that experience in this next series of questions. So the first question is, for the future, how would you contrast Microsoft with other development environments? And that is the pros and cons of each, and why choose Microsoft?
So as I say, part of the choice of Microsoft for me has just been historical. And it came from, again, that kind of contextual thing. It's like, well, I'm building an environment for, you know, a laptop machine running Windows. What else would I choose other than Microsoft in this environment in some sense? So sometimes you choose things because it's the only logical answer, even if there might be other better technologies floating around at that particular point in time. So, for example, I mean, when we started to do Silicon Shock in 2000, we did look into whether we should use Java. I mean, in some sense, our choice was between Java and C++, and there are a lot of things to recommend Java as a development environment relative to C++. You know, memory, there's a lot of discussion, you know, these days about whether garbage collection and memory management are good or bad things. But, you know, when you're trying to get things done very quickly and you're trying to build applications for end users as opposed to things that may be dealing with very severe performance or scaling kind of issues, that memory management really does make it easier to get software out the door. It gives your developers less things to think about. And so, I mean, we actually did have to look at those things and say, well, you know, what are we going to win and lose if we use Java versus C++? Now, it turned out in the case of Silicon Shock that we really needed to do some pretty low-level stuff in terms of manipulating the video card and audio and that kind of stuff. And so really that forced our hand in the direction of using C++, at using Visual Studio, so living inside that Microsoft environment for C++. And so as I say, for me, you know, part of that is just that it's hard to switch technology gears, right? You have to learn a lot of stuff if you're going to switch into a new development environment. And so I have kind of continued on down the path of Microsoft technologies, partially because it's just been the path of least resistance for me. But there are differences. I mean, I think that there are clear differences and advantages and disadvantages between kind of Microsoft technologies and, you know, more of the kind of open source technologies, because I think that's the big alternative that one has. In the database area, we certainly have, you know, a couple of vendors. You know, you've got Microsoft with SQL Server, you've got Oracle, that kind of stuff. In the development technologies, I mean, kind of you've got Microsoft and their proprietary stack, and I think the big contrast there is in the open source world. Things like Eclipse, for example. Eclipse, Java. So there are some definite differences between those things. There's also a certain extent to which it doesn't matter. At its core, software development is the same regardless of whether you're doing it in C or C++ or C# or JavaScript, or it should be at any rate. There are concepts that, you know, span all of these things. All the notions of, you know, functions, lists, iteration, abstraction, encapsulation, separation of concerns, control flow, et cetera, et cetera. These exist, you know, pretty much uniformly across all programming languages. So as a software developer, in a sense, you should try not to tie yourself to a particular technology stack, and you should try to recognize what these abstractions and commonalities are across all of these things, and be willing to change. I say this despite the fact that I say I haven't changed, because I guess in some sense I've been lucky enough that I haven't ever encountered a situation where I had to. I've been lucky enough that I've been able to continue on without actually making any significant changes. Although I did make a significant change in switching to Microsoft at Silicon Shock, because prior to that point I had been a Unix C programmer. That was my background prior to working at Silicon Shock. So I've kind of had one moment in my life where I've made these very significant technology changes. So again, I mean, that's trying to set the groundwork for this, which is saying that, you know what, there are differences, but try to avoid the religion here. You know, it is not the case that one of these things is so much better than the others that clearly everybody in the world should be using it, and that's the end of the story. It's not the truth. These things have fundamentally more similarities than they do differences. And I don't think that that actually comes out particularly well. I think that, again, there's a tendency in software developers to be religious about the tools that they're using and to want to prove to the world how much better these are than everything else. And again, we can see this kind of thing happening over and over again in the field. You know, we've got SQL and now we've got NoSQL, and you can go out there and you can find a billion blog posts of people saying why NoSQL is just so much better, and it's just like everything's switched to NoSQL. There's no use for SQL databases anymore. It's not that simple, right? I mean, there are situations where NoSQL databases make sense. There are situations where SQL databases make sense, and there's a range of situations in the middle where probably you could use either one effectively. And so I want to downplay basically the extent to which there are differences that are just like so amazingly different that they make one way of doing things infinitely better than another way of doing things. That being said, there are some interesting aspects to Microsoft technologies that we make use of as a development team on an ongoing basis, and that don't exist in some of the other areas. I mentioned one of these already. So I think one of the most significant, interesting pieces of technology to come out of Microsoft recently is Link, this language integrated query, which gives you the ability to, as I say, make SQL-like queries, but do it in the context of a programming language like C# or like VB.NET or even like F#, and pull back data or manipulate data in a functional way. And that's really what's interesting about it. Is SQL is a functional language. It's not an imperative language, at its core, it's a functional language. It's a way of making declarative specifications about the set of data that you want, and the database then interprets those and gives you back that information. And that's a really, well, for many programmers, that's a different mindset. So, kind of in the programming language, universe, we've got these two really big areas of development. We've got functional programming languages and procedural programming languages. And in functional programming languages, it's more about describing, how things are going to be, whereas in procedural ones, you're saying how to do it. You're saying do this, do this, do this, do this, whereas in a functional language, you're saying it's more declarative. You're more like saying, well, this is what I want, and you assume that the language is going to be able to produce that result for you. So by introducing, I'll back off a little tiny bit. C# is clearly a procedural programming language. Most of the time when you're sitting down and you're programming in C#, you're saying do this, do this, do this, do this. But now we pull in Link, and suddenly we have inside of C# another programming language, but it's in C#, it's part of C#, and it's functional. It's a functional language. So in the middle of my my procedural language, I now have this declarative language embedded inside of it. And I think that that's made for a very interesting transition for programmers who at least take advantage of this fact. And it's certainly true for me when I am developing code myself, is that I have switched to being a much more functional programmer as a result. Not only do I use functional programming in the context of Link itself, but it has opened my eyes to using functional constructs which exist in C Sharp as well. So, you know, C Sharp has this ability to create so-called lambdas, so to create functions on the fly, basically. And I have become a much more extensive user of this capability. So if you, you know, were to go back 5 years and look at some code that I wrote and then come now and look at if I were to write a similar piece of code today, 5 years ago, it would have been very procedural. Do this, do this, do this, do this. Now, what it would be, there'd be some very coarse grain. Do this, and then do this. But inside of those would be large blocks of functional programming instead. And I think that's a fairly significant change. And it's a change that, I think has been a little bit slower to come to some of the other programming languages. I mean, you can do some of these things in Java, but they're a little bit clunkier and a little bit harder, and there is nothing like Link, as far as I know, inside the Java framework. JavaScript, interestingly, you know, being a more recent language, has always had kind of functional programming capabilities, and so, in fact, you know, many of the people who are developing JavaScript applications have been living in this more functional world all along, although, you know, I'm not sure how much they actually appreciate the fact that there are these two different ways of doing things, and that there is a kind of a style or a way of doing things in a functional way that's different from procedure. And JavaScript, I guess, like C Sharp, is a combination language. It is both procedural but has functional elements inside of it. So, in terms of Microsoft and other technologies, that's one of the things about Microsoft that has drawn me to it, is that they have this language integrated query stuff, which it's just pervasive in our code. You cannot look at 10 lines of our code and not see a link query somewhere inside of there, because, you know, this is what we do with software developers. We're manipulating data, and Link is a language for manipulating data. So once you start using it, you see it everywhere. And one of the things that's nice about Link is that it can be applied in a variety of different contexts. So you can use the same language, this Link language, to manipulate a list of integers, or to manipulate information that's in your database, or to manipulate information that, you know, is just living on disk somewhere but not inside a database. I mean, there's a way of mapping it down into all of these different technologies so that you have a unified language, but it is targeting a variety of different kinds of data. Pushing on the boundaries of that, Microsoft has developed another technology which is a kind of an extension of Link, which is called RX, the Reactive Extensions for Link. And what this is again, using that same Link syntax, that same unified query language, but for processing events or streams of events. And so, again, there's another big area of programming that's concerned with what we call event-oriented programming. And RX provides a really unique and interesting way to do event-oriented programming, where you're, again, using this query language to manipulate the events rather than, for example, having an event handler. So again, in event-oriented programming, the way that you might normally do this is, okay, I know that there's some events coming along, so I'm going to write a piece of code called an event handler that's going to get called every time one of these events arrives, and then I'm going to do some stuff with that event. That's a kind of a procedural way of doing things. You know, with RX, instead, you're doing a functional way of doing things. You're saying, here is a data query that I want to execute against this stream of events that are coming in, and I want to select certain ones of them out, and then I want to be able to kind of pass that along to somebody else. And so you end up creating these kinds of chains of things that are processing the events, rather than having a whole bunch of these event handlers that are handling some events and then, you know, pushing them back out again. So there's another, I think, technology that I'm not aware of, or that certainly has come out of the Microsoft technology stack and may not be as well represented outside of that. In terms of downsides for Microsoft technologies, I mean, those are usually pretty easy for people to come up with. Well, one is cost. You know, the tools from Microsoft are not free. Open source tools are free. I can go out and get a copy of Eclipse, you know, the open source development environment. Eclipse started out being a development environment for Java, but it's actually an amazingly architected piece of software that's incredibly flexible, has a really nice plug-in architecture, and so Eclipse has expanded from being, from its roots as a Java development environment, to being a development environment that can be targeted to, you know, a wide variety of open source environments. So, you know, and it, so there's an incredibly sophisticated piece of software out of the open source community, and it's free. I mean, you just pick it up and start using it. So one of the things that people are saying is like, you know, why would anybody use a Microsoft technology when I can go and I can pick up something like Eclipse and just start using it? So cost is always going to be an issue in comparisons of a proprietary technology. Obviously, Microsoft's not the only proprietary technology out there, but proprietary technologies versus open source technologies is cost. The other one that people really are concerned about is vendor lock-in. You buy a proprietary tool stack from somebody like Microsoft, you're kind of married to them now. They own you, because it can be challenging to get out of that environment. I mean, if you look at marine learning systems, for example, we have, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of lines of C# code. Well, pretty much the only people that can turn that C# code into an actual application are those tools from Microsoft. It would not be easy. It would be gruesomely difficult for us to abandon that and switch over to a different environment. And so there's a lock-in problem there. Now you've got a lock-in problem on the open source side as well. I mean, in the same way, it's not easy to switch from Java to a different programming language. But the problem is less severe, because it is an open source environment, and typically you have more choices. One of the choices that you have is always, in the open source community, to do it yourself, because the source code is there. You don't like what Eclipse is doing? Fine. Grab the source code for Eclipse and build what you want. And you can do that because the open source movement, in some sense, guarantees that source code is going to be there for you to do that with. You don't like what the Java compiler is doing. You need some special feature. You need whatever. Fine. Do it. Grab the source code for the Java compiler and build one of those things yourself. So, there is, as with any technology, there's going to be some lock-in. But when you're using open source technologies, you have a lot more possibilities available to you. Whereas when you've locked yourself to a particular vendor, well, you've locked yourself to that particular vendor and you're at their mercy. So I would say that those are the two downsides that people often cite with Microsoft technology, is that, well, it's not free and you've got a vendor lock-in problem, which compounds the not free part of it. Is that, I mean, if Microsoft decides they're going to make this stuff more expensive tomorrow, you're going to feel some pain as a result of that. Also, following along with the kind of the source code part of it. So I would say that those are two big issues, cost and proprietary lock-in. Another issue is technology transparency, I guess would be the way to say this. And that, again, just comes from the availability of the source code. If you want to understand how the Java compiler works, like if you need to, if you're dealing with something that's so deep, dark down in the details of things that it becomes important for you to know what's happening, well, you can know. You can go grab that source code and you can look at it. You can build the product. You can debug it. You can trace it. You can look at what's happening in your tooling and gain a very deep understanding of what's occurring. Well, Microsoft is not giving away the source code for Visual Studio. So, you know, or for their compilers. So if you get to a situation where you really want to know what's happening inside those tools, you're kind of stuck. You have limited visibility. Unlike the open source community, you can't just go in and figure it out for yourself. Interestingly, Microsoft has been, I think, moving more in the direction of an open source kind of mentality for things. Now, they can't do it completely. They're a company. They have to make money. They're going to have products to sell. But that being said, they are definitely making an effort to take some of their areas of technology and make the source code available to them. So, for example, ASP.NET, which is the framework which is used to render web pages for web-based applications, is something that they've recently open sourced. And so now you can, you know, if you care about what's going on inside the bowels of ASP.NET, you can know that. You can go and you can look at the source code for those things as well. So I think that even Microsoft understands the value of technology transparency, that sometimes developers really do need to know what's going on in order to be able to build their products, and they are trying as best they can to provide some of that technology transparency.
You know, you talked about Link earlier. I guess you've had some interesting conversations with Eric Meyer.
Yes. I started using Link before I had met with Eric, but Eric is on the Q editorial board, so he is somebody that I see on a relatively regular basis. He's also the person who authored the RX extension. And so, yes, occasionally I get to sit down and ask kind of the godlike figure of this environment how certain things work. So, yes, it's very nice to be able to be working on Link or RX using these technologies at work and have a direct line back to somebody who you know is going to be able to give you the answer for things.
Well, that puts a smile on my face. I can imagine the conversations. The next question is about Windows 8.1. I don't know if you have any recommendations on that new operating system.
Well, this is sort of interesting. So I've been using Windows 8 on my desktop at work for probably close to the last year. And I don't mind it. In fact, I like it. So I may be one of the few people in the entire universe who appears to like Windows 8. It is far from perfect. I mean, there are aspects of it that just seem to be weird. So, I mean, of course, the big complaint that people have about Windows 8 is this deranged split personality, that there's a kind of a tile-based interface, what people... The name for which people keep changing, I guess, you know, Microsoft had originally called it the Metro-style interface, but there were some trademark issues, and so it's not referred to as the Metro-style interface. So sometimes people talk about it as the interface that was Metro, or the interface that used to be named Metro, or I'm not sure what the appropriate terminology is for it now. I'll call it Metro, because that's a nice, short, easy-to-use word. So you've got your Metro interface, your tiles, your various applications, and then you've got your desktop. Now, your desktop, I mean, looks pretty much like Windows 7, right? And you go in there and you've got a taskbar. The only thing that's missing is the start menu, and that causes people a lot of grief and pain that there is no start menu there. But, you know, for me, it was something that was relatively easy to work around. It's like, okay, I got no start menu. I'm gonna take these applications that I normally use, and I'm gonna pin them to the taskbar, and I'm gonna make some adjustments in my life, and I'm gonna be able to use Windows 8. And, you know, for me, it was like, I guess kind of like talking about programming, which is the stuff like technology changes. You better get used to adapting. So even if it's painful, even if you're going to have to make some adjustments, you might as well just get used to it and do these things. So that was kind of my attitude with Windows 8. It's like, I know people are complaining about it, but I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to live with the pain to find out, you know, what's going on and to kind of stay with the direction that the technologies are moving. Because I don't think Microsoft is going to go backwards on this. I think that I have an appreciation for why they've built it the way that they have. I certainly think that, obviously, the mobile device category has assumed this incredible importance in the overall technology landscape. And it's done so in a relatively short period of time. So, you know, 5 years ago, there weren't any almost mobile devices. I know that's a lie because I've been using mobile devices for a decade. But, you know, really, when people talked about computing, they were talking about desktop computing, and that's all there was to it. And now, you know, over a relatively short period of time, suddenly it's almost like PCs don't exist anymore. And again, that's not true. Of course, there's still lots of us using PCs. They still have a role in the world. But, you know, where all the buzz is, where all the excitement is obviously around these mobile devices. And, you know, I have no insight to what people are talking to at Microsoft, but I can certainly imagine the kind of discussions that must have been in there. It's like, well, you know, there's this whole category of devices out there that we're not present on anymore, and we need to be present. You know, we need to come up with a way of being viable in that environment. And the Metro environment actually seems to work pretty well on a mobile device. So, you know, when you're using a touch device or something like that, it actually feels pretty good. I like it in that environment. And so Microsoft was faced with a really big problem, which was, how are we going to get these two things to live together? And they chose the most expedient, if not perhaps best solution, which is, well, we're just going to kind of run them together. Like, we're going to do a head-on between two trains here, and we'll just kind of get what we get out at the end. that's probably not a particularly fair description for things, but I think that's the way that a lot of people feels about Windows 8. So, you know, here we have the Metro interface, and here we have the desktop interface, and they've been kind of sewn together like Siamese twins or something. But it's okay. I mean, as a person who uses this on a daily basis, I said that's my main machine at work is a Windows 8 machine. I don't find any particular problem with it at all.
You know, it's interesting. I've got now a Windows-based tablet, and prior to that, I had an Apple iPad. In fact, several generations of Apple iPad, and now my preferred tool probably is the Windows tablet. So I've gotten quite accustomed to the tile interface, and then switching to the desktop and so on. And I think with the Windows 8.1 added features, it'll just make it even that much easier. I experimented with Android, and I just found that it's a little bit not as intuitive as either the Apple environment or the Microsoft environment. So in terms, I guess my preference is probably now Windows, using Windows 8, and then or 8.1 or 8.x, and then followed by the Apple environment and followed by the Android environment. And it's just interesting, I was talking to the chair of the deans of IT, and he has been experimenting with different tablets, and including having purchased, the Apple iPad. And then he actually tried a Surface Pro, and now he says he just loves it because you can do everything with it, and you don't have to kind of use something in one environment and then, you know, use the iPad for something else. He uses the Surface Pro for everything. Myself, I've got an HP ElitePad, which is a Windows tablet, but addresses some of the features that the Surface Pro doesn't have, because it has cellular built into it. It has some of the other sort of things that people wanted, like it supports an additional battery, things like that. So I actually like it quite a bit. But anyways, that's sort of my point of view. Okay, so Terry, those are some really interesting insights that you've given on Windows and the Windows environment, because, you know, you've been an active user of Windows 8 for some time. You also talked about mobile. So let's delve into that a little bit deeper. What are your recommendations for mobile adoption and usage in enterprises?
Interesting. Again, I mean, as a guy who's more or less only been involved in startups for a very long period of time, I don't have a lot of direct exposure to the forces that come into play at an enterprise-level company with regard to the mobile devices that their employees have. Now, I mean, it is just completely obvious to me, and I mean, presumably to you and every one of your listeners, that mobile technology is absolutely here to stay. I mean, that it's an incredible value add, and that it is going to be a part of any enterprise level kind of IT plan moving forward. I mean, the devices are clearly more well suited to the kinds of interactions that somebody has when they're on the go. You know, if they're out in the field doing stuff, if you've got salespeople, if you've got anybody who's traveling or moving away, who's not sitting at a desk. So if you're sitting at a desk every day, I can't imagine why you'd be using a mobile device. If you've got enough room for a keyboard and a monitor, aside perhaps, I guess, maybe from, touch interactions sometimes being a little bit more straightforward, you can get touch screen displays, so you could do that sort of thing. But I find it difficult to imagine sitting at a desk and using a tablet for doing various things. It's extremely rare for me to do that at work. I mean, I've got my phone in my pocket, I've got my tablet with me, but, I almost never ever do anything with them, during the day. The only time that I will pick up and use my phone is if I need to actually make a call, which is something that's I shouldn't even say it's impossible. I make a lot of calls from Skype sitting on my desktop as well. So, I mean, there's a lot of times, occasionally, for whatever reason, the calls are things that Skype doesn't deal with particularly well, or where I'm worried about the quality issues that might be associated with Skype. And the other thing that I use my phone for is SMSs, because I still haven't really come across a really convenient way of being able to do SMSs to everybody who's in my contact list except by going to my phone. And partially that has to do just with separation between personal contact list and work contact list. So again, you can use Skype to send SMSs, but there's a whole bunch of people who are in my phone that aren't on my Skype account that I'm typically using at work. So that's kind of a background. It's like, if you're sitting at a desk all day, then I don't understand why you'd be using a mobile device, frankly. Maybe some people would prefer to, but it strikes me as odd. The desktop clearly has more power. It is clearly more efficient to type things out on a keyboard than it is to try and thumb things in on a mobile device, or even use Swipe, which I use on my Android devices and I think is a marvelous input mechanism. But still, I can produce content faster with a keyboard than I can with any of those other methods. But if you don't sit at a desk all day, if you get up and move around, and even if it is you're just moving around the office, I mean, even if it is that you're the kind of guy who's attending meetings a lot, so you're not sitting at your desk, but you're sitting in various other rooms around the company, then the mobile device is clearly the way that you're going to function. You can't haul your desktop computer around with you, and you need some way of continuing to interact with the world, to be able to take notes, et cetera, et cetera. So mobile devices are clearly going to be a part of any enterprise IT strategy. Beyond that, there's a whole bunch of issues associated with them that, as I say, I don't have a great deal of experience with. So there's a lot of policy, procedural, and operational stuff going on in terms of, you know, data management, stuff like that. Well, if you've got these mobile devices and these mobile devices have sensitive corporate data on them, then you need to have mechanisms to make sure that that sensitive corporate data isn't going to go places that it shouldn't go. So you need to think about what kind of IT infrastructure is going to be necessary to support that with the kinds of mobile devices that your employees are going to be using. And you've got issues about whether your mobile strategy is going to be a bring-your-own-device versus a provided device. And if you're going to have a bring-your-own-device style of strategy, you've got to ask questions about, well, how do we separate the personal from the corporate information on those particular devices so that the person can continue to use this device for their own and at the same time still have this other stuff that's not really their own. It belongs to the corporation, but it's now living on this same device. And, you know, frankly, a lot of smaller organizations are probably just sailing in the wind on these fronts. You know, it's like people are bringing in devices and data is getting transferred onto them and there's not a lot of control happening. And so there's a little bit, I suspect, of the Wild West happening out there right at the moment with respect to the way that mobile devices are handled inside organizations, again, particularly smaller organizations. The larger organizations have, you know, enough resources and enough sophistication to understand what the problems are and the resources to be able to actually go out and attempt to solve them. Smaller organizations, you know, may not have experienced the issues, may not have the sophistication, and may not have the resources. So there's a number of reasons why, you know, the mobile device issue for them could be one that's maybe a little bit out of control, where they're not kind of having the degree of control over information that they were accustomed to when all they had to deal with was a bunch of desktops. Even so, you know, laptops have been around for a while, and laptops have, to a certain extent, already introduced us to these types of problems, that, you know, information that used to be only living inside the four walls of your building was now walking out of your building on somebody's laptop. So it's not as if these issues are completely, totally brand new within the couple of years. You know, we've been dealing with some of them at least for 15 or 20 years as, you know, mobile computing has moved from back in the day, the good old days of the Osborne. My wife actually had one of the Osbornes. I don't know whether you remember those guys, the old luggable computers. So as I say, there's a lot of issues about mobile device adoption inside enterprise organizations, and I have a superficial understanding of what some of the nature of the challenges is or are, and I have almost no sense of the nature of the solutions that are available for those types of things, again, except at a very superficial level. So, I mean, obviously, lots of things for people to be aware of, to keep their eyes open for. And, you know, my only recommendation is be aware of those things and start to think about how these things are going to affect the IT infrastructure of your organization.
Terry, we're going to go back into your sweet spot, which is all about development. And I know you use Visual Studio. Can you tell me what you Or let me rephrase this. What would be your top recommendations for using the latest edition of Visual Studio?
Interesting question. I mean, one of the in the past, I have had the opportunity to use a product that goes along with Visual Studio called the Team Foundation Server. So Team Foundation product suite from Microsoft provides tools for a number of things that, you know, happen inside development organizations. So Team Foundation Server provides source code control, provides defect management, provides a testing framework, both manual and automatic, provides all of these tools in a way that they are absolutely and completely integrated with one another. My experiences with Team Foundation Server, and they're quite old, I unfortunately have not been able to use the product recently. My experience with it in the past were that it was a marvelously integrated system. I absolutely enjoyed using it as both a developer and a development manager because it made it very easy to navigate through information. So, for example, if there was a bug report and that bug report resulted in a new test case being developed, and that bug report resulted in some changes in the source code control system. I mean, there was source that changed as a result. It was really easy to navigate from that stuff inside Team Foundation. You could go in and you could do a search and you could find the bug and you could say, okay, there's the bug, there's the description, when it was found, how you reproduce it, when it was solved. Here's a link to the source code changes that went along with the fix for this. Here's a link that goes along to the tests that were done for this. Here's all the history of all the changes. So it's like, wow, this is amazing. It provides a way to navigate through the history of the organization very, very easily. Now, I don't know whether the open source world provides a really nicely integrated environment like that. That corresponds to that, because I've just never been in a position where I've had to set one up. Team Foundation Server, however, was complicated to set up. Back when I did it, it literally took me months to get it totally configured. It was an astoundingly flexible product. And so the process of actually configuring it to map onto the organization was tough. It took a long time. And I've never been at a company since where I've had the luxury to be able to do that. It's like, you know, when I started working at Marine LS, it's like, we need to be coding tomorrow. We don't have 2 months to set up Team Foundation Server. And so it's like, oh, okay, I know I'd like to, but I can't. We need to get things done. Often in the world of startups, a phrase that I use with people that I work with, it's like, in a startup, you care about what's going to kill you today, not what's going to kill you tomorrow. So you have this really kind of short, it's like, I know that I'd like to set up Team Foundation Server. I know that in some sense it would be better for me in the long run, but not having it is not going to kill me today. And so I'm not going to do it. It's an unfortunate situation to be in where your hand is forced essentially all the time, where you just, you know, by the exigencies of the current situation, you can't quite get to where you'd like to be. So the world that I live in now is one where we have, you know, pieced together a number of different systems, and they're not really integrated with one another, or partially integrated. So we use Visual Studio. We use SVN for our source code control. Most of us use a product called Tortoise SVN, which provides integration between the File Explorer in Microsoft and the back-end Tortoise repository. Provides a visual integration, so you can basically be in File Explorer and say, I want to update the files in this folder, for example, as opposed to the command line interface, which is how kind of SVN works under the covers. It's like a traditional Unix tool where you would issue commands on the command line instead. There's another tool called Ankh, which provides an integration between SVN and Visual Studio. I actually don't use that, interestingly, but a number of other people in the office do. So what that means is that inside Visual Studio, you can go in and you can click on a particular file and say that you would like to update it or you would like to commit the changes in it. I guess an interesting question is, like, why don't I use that? I mean, it seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to do, and it's like, I've used it in the past, and it slowed down Visual Studio enough that it made me unhappy, and even though people say it's fast now, I've never gotten to the point again of, you know, wanting to spend the time of installing it and that kind of thing. So an interesting, you know, example of fragmentation even in my own workplace. Our bug tracking system is another online system which has the odd name of AccuNode. And it's not really actually specifically a bug tracking system. It's actually an agile task planning tool. I really like it. It's not wildly popular as far as I can tell. I haven't met anybody else who's using it, but I really like its set of features. And for a small organization like ours, it's actually free. It's one of these kind of interesting freemium products where you can just kind of use it for free. But it also functions as our bug tracking system. So, you know, tasks to develop a piece of particular software and a task to fix a bug are really just two different kinds of tasks that we manipulate inside this system. And for testing, we use a variety of bits and pieces of things. I mean, primarily a tool called NUnit, which is there for running unit tests inside your C# code. And another product called Team City, which is for doing continuous deployment. Now, as I say, we actually don't do continuous deployment to our live sites, but we do kind of do a continuous deployment internally for our test machines and stuff like that. Just, again, so when people check in code, that test cases are run, that kind of stuff. So we have this kind of fragmented environment. You know, we've got all the bits and pieces, but they're not totally connected with one another. And as I say, I don't know what the story in the open source world is. So if, you know, my advice to people would be, I guess kind of the advice is like, if you have the time, I think an integrated solution for these things would be great, because I sometimes yearn for those types of things, that I wish that I were able to very easily go into our bug tracking system, for example, and find the corresponding code changes. And as it is, you know, we depend on a whole bunch of conventions that we use. So when we check in code that comes from a bug, we include the AccuNote task number as a cross-reference. So if I want to do it, what I need to do is I need to look in the bug tracking system, I need to read the comment, I need to extract the change set ID from that, and then I need to go over into SVN and ask it to show me that kind of thing. So I can do it, I can achieve most of the results, but it's a manual process. I have to, you know, go it and filter through these things. And there's a lot of reporting and stuff that we don't get out of stuff. We actually, I mean, on the QA side, for example, we really don't have a good mechanism for recording the results of test case runs. So NUnit can tell us about automatic testing, but manual test case runs, we really have very little tracking and data on, and I really miss that. In the past, I've had systems where we could easily examine, a particular test run against a particular revision of the software, and we could see how many of the test cases had been run, how many were still being worked on by testers, how many of them had passed, how many bugs come out of those things, and there were nice reporting features to pull all of that information out of the system. And those things are, I think as a development manager, that kind of reporting capability is incredibly useful, and I don't have it right now, and I miss it. So my recommendation would be, you know, particularly to development managers, not so much to software developers, but to development managers, to think about whether they can get an integrated solution, to think about the kind of reporting that they want, and make sure that they get that stuff in place when they've got breathing space. Because, I mean, really, once you start developing code, you're not going to have that breathing space anymore. You're constantly going to have things to do with the code. And so it's like in the life of a development manager, there's usually this tiny little window where you may have an opportunity to choose a different tool set and do something different. And if you don't strike when that little window of opportunity is there, you're going to be stuck using whatever it is that's already in your organization, or, you know, that has been the kind of infrastructure, I guess, that's set up for you already for doing stuff. From an individual developer perspective, I mean, DevStudio often strikes me. I mean, it's a wonderful environment as far as I'm concerned. I really like it. And we don't use a lot of extensions in our office. So, I mean, one of the nice things about Visual Studio is that Microsoft has created this integration API so that third-party vendors and even open source developers can create plugins for Visual Studio that do various things for you. And so I mentioned before, there's this Ankh plugin that provides SVN access directly through Visual Studio. So it's an example of a plugin that somebody has developed, and that is an open source one. And so there are a number of these plugins, but we don't actually use a lot of them in our office, so I don't have a great deal of experience with them. And Visual Studio itself provides a phenomenal set of capabilities just out of the box. So again, I mean, I think a recommendation that I would have for a developer is, like, be aware of what the capabilities of your tools are. So for example, inside Visual Studio, there are some really nice refactoring capabilities. And one that I make use of all the time is one called extract method. And what you can do is you go in to an existing piece of code that you have, and you select a range of lines of that code, and you say extract method. And what it does is it picks those lines of code out, creates a new method for them, drops them into the body of that method, figures out what the parameters should be based on all the variables that are referenced in that block of code, creates those parameters for the method, declares the method in the interface that you have to be. And so it basically, it makes it possible to kind of do the divide and conquer thing on your source code, which I think is a fundamental aspect of software development. You don't want methods or functions that are thousands of lines long, because no human brain can understand that much information at that time. So, you know, one of the reasons that we use abstraction in software development, as far as I'm concerned, is because abstraction is a native capability of the human brain. Human brains work in terms of abstractions. We like to hide details. And so, in software development, we use abstraction because that's a way of making the source code more understandable of things. But what happens naturally over time is that you build a bit of functionality, and then something gets added to it, and something gets added to it. And by the time, you know, you've gone through a few iterations, you now have these methods or these functions that are hundreds or, you know, possibly thousands of lines long. And so a tool like extract method makes it easy to break those things down and go, okay, here's, you know, here's a chunk of this thing. I can separate this out into another method, so I can do a little bit of abstraction. If I had to do it by hand, I probably wouldn't do it, you know, because I'd have to cut and paste those things out, and I'd have to put a declaration. The fact that the, you know, Visual Studio was willing to just do that little bit of overhead for me, it just takes care of a few of those little tasks, makes the difference for me between doing that refactoring and not doing that refactoring. And so as a developer, you know, you want to be aware of the capabilities of your tools, because they could make a huge difference to the nature of code that you're producing. Again, for me, you know, this is the difference between producing good micro abstractions in the context of my code and not doing that. And as a result, in some sense, I would say I produce better code because I am now making use of this feature. And, you know, I don't know whether anybody in the office was kind of aware of that feature before I started showing it to them and say, hey, look, you know, we're writing these really big routines all the time. Let's try to break them down into smaller pieces. And I would say, you know, and you know what? Visual Studio has a thing that makes it easy to do this. You just go blah and click this thing on the menu, and away you go. You're off to the races. And as I say, I don't think most of them are aware of it. And I'm not saying that I know everything about Visual Studio. I don't. Visual Studio has got a huge range of capabilities. So, you know, there's just stuff to learn all the time. So it's like, you know, just be aware. Your tools, and whether it's Visual Studio or whether it's Eclipse or whatever it is that you're using, your tool probably has all kinds of features, that you're not aware of. And you should spend some time to, look around at what other people are doing, you know, other developers in your office and what other people are online, and just be aware of the fact that there's opportunities for learning and things that you can do that will make you a better software developer.
So on this next question, we're just going to broaden it a bit. Now, throughout this entire conversation, you've been talking about, you know, providing recommendations and on various kinds of technologies and more than on technologies. And you've been making recommendations on Microsoft and so on. Do you have any other sort of broader recommendations you want to make on Microsoft platforms and technologies?
Probably not on Microsoft. I think because we've kind of touched on the things that I use on a daily basis. So, and you know, and there are lots of other places where I think clearly there are interesting comparisons to be made, but I don't have the experience to make them. You know, there's SQL Server versus Oracle. I just don't have enough background there, but you know, that's clearly an area where there's a lot of information that's out there on the net, and you should pay attention if you are in the situation where you have to make that choice. For us, you know, we're working with NAD framework, we're using Microsoft, we just kind of use SQL Server by default, and frankly, we're not, you know, sort of super high performance users of the database, so we haven't gotten into a situation where, you know, maybe Oracle had some kind of a feature that would be better for us than using SQL Server would. Cloud services. Microsoft has, you know, Azure out there, and you've got Amazon with S3 and Elastic Computing. You've got Google with the Google App Engine. And so there's some really interesting comparisons to be made there. I know a little bit more about that area. I would like to be able to actually move our application into the Azure environment. There are certain things about the Azure environment that I think are really nice. In particular, their mechanisms for queuing asynchronous tasks between different components of a system automatically, or providing infrastructure for helping you do that, which I think are would be really vital to being able to build good cloud-based applications. But again, you know, I'm not having not deployed into any of those environments, I am not really intimately familiar with the detailed decisions that go down there. So there are lots of other interesting areas of Microsoft technologies that I just haven't had the opportunity to touch down on enough to be able to provide reasonable recommendations. But it's certainly, you know, the rule stands, which is be aware of what your needs are and try to map those very carefully onto the technology that you're choosing.
This will probably be the last question on regarding sort of software from a general perspective standpoint. Do you have any other recommendations for good architecture?
Good architecture is, I think there's a lot more debate about that in the software development community. For example, there's a big tension between people who like frameworks and people who don't like frameworks. I'm on the like frameworks side of things, but I certainly understand the motivations for the people who are claiming that, you know, frameworks tend to be evil. And it's the same, it actually sort of relates back to previous comments I was making about abstraction. I tend to be a big believer in abstraction. I believe in encapsulation. I believe in separation of concerns. And I believe these things primarily from the point of view of maintainability of code. That is, the machine doesn't care about these things. You know, when the machine is executing the low-level code that makes up your application, it doesn't care whether you designed it with an abstraction in mind or not. It just executes instructions. So all of this is about people and not machines. I believe in these things because I believe they make it easier to understand code. They make it easier to reason about what it's doing. They make it easier for somebody to approach the code and modify it. They make it easier to write test cases and that kind of stuff. So it's all predicated on the notion that you're going to actually maintain this code base. Well, that's not necessarily the case. I mean, it goes back to look at the forces that are in play for what you're developing. Well, I'm suggesting, you know, when I suggest that I like these things or that I think that these things are valuable, what I'm really saying is, well, I'm working in an environment where I think we're going to have to maintain this code base over time. What if that wasn't true? You know, what if the code that you were writing was like a one-off and you were going to basically create it and then you knew it was just going to go, in some sense, go away? Well, that may sound silly, but there are situations that are kind of like that. Game programmers developing games that are going onto cartridges or something like that, I mean, those cartridges can't be fixed once they're delivered. I mean, they're ROMs, they're fixed. So in a sense, when you write a game for one of those things and you ship it out the door, it's like, well, you don't have to worry about maintenance. The cartridges have gone out the door and they're gone. You can't fix them anymore. There's nothing to maintain. So the forces at play in developing that kind of software are different than the ones that I normally encounter in the types of things. And so, you know, in those environments, abstraction or frameworks may not be as valuable because, well, nobody's going to look at that code again. Now, again, that's an extreme because even in a game situation, there's some of that code may be reused from one game to another, so there are some maintenance issues. You know, again, there are different forces at play depending on who your customer is, what kind of software you're doing, how you're delivering it. All of these things come into play, and they make a difference about the choices that you make. I'd find it really hard, personally, I would find it really hard to not write stuff the way that I do. Like, I believe so deeply in abstraction that if you threw me into one of those gaming environments and said, you know, we don't care about any of that stuff, it'd be really hard for me. I mean, intellectually, I understand that I shouldn't be doing these things because they don't apply in that situation. But as a person, I would find it difficult to actually stop doing those things because they're very deeply ingrained in the way that I write code. Similarly, I tend to write, the applications, the environments that I have been in have tended to be ones where we haven't had to deal with massive scaling on short timescales. So again, if we go back to the kind of freemium consumer-based applications, I mean, the general goal is there, we're going to write this thing, we're going to put it out on the net, and we want it to go viral, which means we want to go from zero users to 10 million users in 2 months. The forces at play there are so radically different because the life or death of that company is not going to be based primarily on how maintainable the code is. The life and death of that company is going to be based on, can we scale it? Because if we can't, we're dead. And so in a universe where you care deeply, deeply, deeply about how quickly you can scale application, scaling and abstraction in frameworks, there's a bit of tension between those things. You know, abstraction is all about hiding details. Performance tuning is all about being aware of details because they probably or they because they could have an impact on performance. So there's a tension there. To develop something with really good abstraction, you may actually be making it harder to do performance tuning on that thing. If you use a framework for doing stuff, again, the framework is controlling certain aspects of the flow of control inside your program. That's, you know, kind of fundamentally what a framework is. It's something that is actually going to be responsible for mitigating or controlling the way that process flows through your application. Well, if the framework is doing those things, it means you're not doing those things. It means you don't have control over them. It means that when you come to try and performance tune those things, well, you may be screwed. I mean, if you've got an open source framework, at least, again, you have the opportunity to go back into the framework and modify what it does. But if you're using a framework from Microsoft, a proprietary thing, and you can't see what's going on inside there and you have no control over it, you may be deeply screwed when it comes down to try and make this thing be performant. And so the context matters. For me, it's okay to choose, you know, Entity Framework and SQL Server because I know that performance, you know, performance is always an issue, but performance is not going to be the sort of life or death issue that it's going to be for one of these companies that's trying to scale quickly. And I know that I'm not going to scale quickly. I'm, you know, we're selling to enterprise customers. Sales cycles are reasonably long. And so there's an opportunity for us to change in the background over time as those sales cycles are occurring. It's not like I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning and there's going to be 10 million people using Marine LMS. It's just not going to happen. And so I don't have to worry about that. I don't have to consider that particular scenario in the way that my software is going to play out. Whereas if I were one of, you know, if I were a CTO at one of these consumer-facing freemium-type offerings, I'd be deeply worried about that. I would be constantly saying, you know, what do we have to do to make sure that we can very, very quickly make this application go faster or, you know, use less machines or expand to different machines and that kind of stuff. And so all of those things feed back, interestingly, I mean, into the software methodology. So the way that you develop software, the things that you value, they're not absolutes. Again, I come close to being a guy who's absolute about encapsulation and separation of concerns. And it's like if I talk to my software developers, I will literally say, the only things that matter in life are encapsulation and separation of concerns, that everything that we do should be driven by these kinds of things. But in the back of my head, I know that I've already conditioned that. I've already evaluated the situation that we're in, and I'm kind of saying those aren't really the only things that we care about or the only things that a software developer ever cares about, but in our particular context, those are the things that we're going to care about. And it's interesting, I need to say, because I think most software developers tend to be really deeply attached, and I understand this because I am deeply attached to them as well. As I say, I would actually find it hard to work in one of these other environments, but intellectually, I understand I shouldn't be that deeply attached to them because they're not absolutes. They are the result of reasoning about what I'm trying to achieve and how I'm going to achieve it. So that's the interesting thing about this. Is like people think that there's a right way of developing software. There isn't. There's not a right way of developing software in the set of a precise set of rules that will say, always do this. It's a meta set of rules that say, look at what you're trying to achieve and create a software development process and create a set of methodologies that will let you achieve those goals. And what's interesting about software is the breadth of possibility there, that there are so many different forces that could be at play and so many different ways of playing stuff out that not one of them is going to ever, there is no way that you could come up with a methodology or an ideology or whatever that would cover off all of those bases.
Now, something that people may not be aware is that you've done a fair amount of research in social media, and you've developed social media applications and or platforms and so on. So I'm going to mine some of this for this next question, and that is, what are some of your recommendations for using social media and collaboration technologies?
I mean, there's a lot of different possibilities, and I guess, I mean, it helps to sort of break them down from almost different business areas. It is true, I have developed social media software. So, I mean, I've actually been building out applications that provide these kind of capabilities. I have used social media software and social media as part of marketing, so in order to actually carry out the marketing and sales aspect of stuff. To a limited extent, I have been involved in using social media for support, so for customer support kinds of things. And there's also the potential for using social media in the context of the development team itself. So it's interesting, you know, all across the organization, if one looks at the various different business areas that exist, we've got sales, we've got marketing, we've got customer support, we've got development, you know, the actual IT infrastructure side of the organization. All of these things can actually use social media in different ways. Well, and that's not surprising, because what's social media really about? It's communication. It's communication dummy. That's all it is. It's like how we exchange information with one another. So, of course, social media applies everywhere, because every aspect of business involves communication. In development organizations, we want to communicate amongst the development team. We need a way to exchange information about, tools, technologies, and techniques that we've uncovered. We need ways to communicate with one another about processes and styles that we're going to follow. So again, you know, even though there's no one right answer for the way to develop software, it's usually better if the development team itself is consistent in the way it develops software, so that you have everybody of the same mindset. And so we need communications tools to help achieve those types of things. Then there's communication in between different pieces of the organization. So, you know, as you noted in previous parts of the conversation, we've talked about the relationship between the kind of the customer side of the organization and the development side of the organization. And there's a huge need for communication there, because software development cannot produce the right product unless there is an understanding of what the customer needs, who the customer is, what their context is, what their pain is, what their processes are like. And so there have to be people out there gathering this information. This information has to be digested and has to be, you know, made available to the development organization. And so social media provides, you know, mechanisms for doing this. So when we say social media, what is it we're really talking about? You know, what are the unique or interesting features that are really helping us do our jobs? Okay, so well, fundamentally, we've got communication. It's a way of getting information around. Social media brings in, I think, the notion of broadcast communications. So, you know, back in the bad old days, broadcast communications we would do through mailing lists. So we'd have a mailing list, and you'd mail things out to that in order for people to see it. I think what social media has done, so when we now start looking at, you know, platforms like Twitter, Facebook, various other things, Yammer, which is more targeted towards enterprises, and many tools like, you know, Salesforce has various add-ons that are associated with it, provide social media capabilities. The fundamental capabilities are similar. You know, we've got content, we're communicating it. What social media or the new capabilities that have come into play over the past couple of years are, I think, one, a sense of history and timeline to things. So there's this notion now that communications are kind of flowing out as a timeline that you can go back and review. So it's more like a stream of information coming to you. Another one is relevance filtering by your social connections to the rest of the organization. So, you know, back in the bad old days of mailing lists, we had a mailing list for this, we had a mailing list for that. If you wanted to learn about these things, you belong to that mailing list. Chances are that mailing list contained a whole bunch of other things that you didn't care about, but you ended up seeing them anyways. And so we kind of have this information overload problem. I think one of the things that social media has brought into this is the notion that the system can help bring things to your attention by understanding your social context. So in a workplace environment, it knows who you're working with, right? Who's on your team. It knows who you interact most closely with. By looking at your history of what it is that you have looked at in the past, by paying attention to where your attention has been focused, it can start to, I will use the word understand, even though that's kind of anthropomorphic, but it can begin to understand what your interests are. And so it can use all of that contextual information to highlight information for you, to help reduce that information overload problem. I think that the other thing that these social media tools have brought into play is just emphasizing how easy communication could be. You know, it doesn't seem very hard to open up your mail tool and compose something to the mailing list, but you know, there's a, I don't know what it is, but there's an emotional barrier there that says this is a kind of a high impedance task. I have to really want to say something in order to go through that little chain of steps. And I don't know why that is. I mean, there's something about the way that human beings work, I think, that creates that barrier. You know, something like Twitter or something like that, or perhaps Yammer, it's like, there's, for some reason, the emotional barrier is less. It's like, okay, if something comes to mind, I can just blat it out on Twitter. There's less of a filter in front of me. And maybe that goes back to the nature of the tools. It's okay to kind of just broadcast information randomly, regardless of how important you think it is, because the tools will help people select the things that are important to them. That the filtering doesn't have to occur on the source, the filtering can occur between the source and the receiver. And maybe that's a kind of a fundamental idea here, that we allow people to be more free in their generation of information, with the understanding that sometimes that information is not going to be useful, sometimes it's only going to be useful to a small set of people, sometimes it's going to be useful to a large set of people. And if we've got some technology in the middle there that helps sort out those issues and make sure that people only see relevant information, then we're in a really excellent position. And I was just talking about that in the context of like a developer organization relating internally to other parts of the organization. But that same dynamic plays out with regard to all the other kinds of examples that I was giving. So, for a support organization, social media can be helpful because, again, they can make a broader array of information available, and clients will see, customers will see the parts of it that they need to, rather than, seeing everything or just receiving this big, gigantic piece of documentation. I think, as well, there's a notion that social media communications are fast. And again, I don't think that there's any particularly underlying technology reason for this. Email's fast. If I send an email, it usually arrives at where it's going within some small number of seconds. So it's not like there's a gigantic delay. But somehow, there's this feeling that Twitter is just like, it's more real time. So you can have customers out there and they've run into a problem, so they just blat it out over Twitter and you are aware of that and a response goes out. There's just this feeling that somehow that system is more responsive and dynamic than an email solution is. And again, when I look at the fundamental components of the technology, I don't see why that is, but that's the way it's played out in reality, is that there are some kind of human factors at work here that mean that for whatever reason, Twitter really is a more dynamic technology than email, even though in some sense maybe it shouldn't be.
You know, you discussed some areas of possible controversy. You know, you talked about functional programming or, you know, use of frameworks and so on. Are there other areas that you would consider highly controversial, you know, where there's a lot of debate, perhaps?
I mean, I think I've mentioned already that I think that the areas that generate the most debate, that are where people are most vociferous and most strongly wedded to their views, have to do with software development methodologies, tools, and kind of design approaches, because they tend to think that there's one way that's going to solve every problem. They tend to think that somewhere out there is, you know, the Fred Brooks silver bullet. And they often think they've found it. And once they think they've found it, they really want to convince the rest of the world that they have found the silver bullet for doing these things. And so you tend to get a lot of very heated discussions between various different people and their various silver bullets. And unfortunately, those conversations never go anywhere because very few people involved in them are willing to take a step back from their position of I have the silver bullet and to look at the more fundamental questions that are going on. It's like, well, what are we really trying to achieve? And how does the tool or technology or process or whatever it is that we're talking about, how does that thing actually relate to that goal that we're trying to achieve? And so they talk at cross purposes. Somebody will say, I've got the best software development methodology and, you know, we can do this and we can do that. And we produce the greatest, you know, it produces the greatest software as the result. And somebody else has got a totally different way of doing things. Like, we produce the greatest software as the result. Well, if one is producing, as per my previous examples, a piece of game software that's going to go on to a ROM cartridge, and another one is producing a web-based consumer application that's intended for rapid scaling over a very short time period, they're not solving the same problem. Yes, they are both developing software, but they are not solving the actual same problem. They're really two very different software development problems. And until people take a step back and understand those things, we will continue to have the flame wars and the religious wars about software development methodologies and tools and languages, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Terry, you have this unique opportunity because you are an active participant of the Q editorial board. You're an active participant of the practitioner board. You chair the case study committee. You are the CTO of a leading edge learning system company. You have your own social media company. You've got this tremendous background in as an executive, but also as an architect and a developer and an innovator. So taking all of those kind of different components, I think you're really you're the hub of an innovation ecosystem. So can you spot or can you tell me what you think are going to be some of the future disruptive innovations that business executives should be watching for?
It's a tough question to answer. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you talk about the kind of entrepreneurial background that I have, but I've always sort of said of myself that I am I'm not a really good entrepreneur in the sense of what I know, what I understand deeply, is software development. I have been a software developer for so long. I have been, as you say, involved in these situations where I've had to lead teams in order to create things. And so, you know, that's just the life that I have lived. And so when I tend to think about, you know, what kind of products I could create or how things could be disruptive, I unfortunately always end up coming back round to software development. And that's actually a really incredibly narrow niche in terms of, you know, what the overall software development community is about. Because the software development community or the whole software development ecosystem is not actually about building software. It's about solving real problems for people in the real world doing other things. At Marine LMS, we help people solve the problem of training their employees in these very specific contexts. And the interesting thing is that, you know, I've been involved in this company very close to since its inception, but I'm not the guy where that original idea came from. You know, I'm not the guy that spotted that there was a need to train people in these kind of contexts. That was really Murray Goldberg. Murray Goldberg is the guy that sort of, you know, had the background with the learning management systems and was interacting with people at BC Ferries and kind of spotted that, hey, look, there's an opportunity here. There's a need here. They're trying to achieve something and technology could help them achieve it. And I, sadly, have never been one of those people in the sense of having an understanding of a non-technology business that has goals to achieve or something. I'm very good at working in those contexts once I've been placed into them. So I'm very good at interacting with customers. I'm very good now at talking to people in shipping companies and understanding what their needs are and translating that back into technology. But I'm not the kind of guy that spotted that need initially. It spotted the opportunity for technology to play a role here. And it's because my life has, in some sense, been this kind of very sheltered one. I develop software. So, you know, I can think of tools that one could possibly build in the software development arena that might help people. And I can certainly, you know, spot areas where I think that the tooling can improve. And it's like, you know, but Visual Studio, it's not a day goes by that I sit down and go, oh man, I wish it could do this, or I wish it could do that, or wouldn't it be great if it were capable of doing these kinds of things. But yeah, I unfortunately, because of that very unique background and that very focused background, don't have the breadth of experience in other parts of the world to see where those opportunities are, which means that, you know, also, I don't actually have a good sense of, you know, where those disruptive capabilities are going to be coming from, because it's not just understanding the technology that matters there, it's understanding everything that's going on in those particular businesses or those particular environments. I think, see the general shape of stuff going on. It's like you say, mobile is going to become increasingly important. I think that we are also probably close to the turning point for more ubiquitous computing technologies, where computing becomes more of the environment and not, you know, kind of these totally always specialized devices. We're always going to have specialized devices. We will always have our personal computing devices, but I think we're getting closer to the point where those personal computing devices are going to start interacting with the environment around them in a more consistent fashion. And I'm really excited about that. I've always been a big fan of ubiquitous computing. So, I mean, I certainly think that I think it's an area to watch out for, but I don't have a good sense of how it's actually going to play out, you know, for businesses, for the overall sort of span of the economy. But you can see little bits of it now. It's like you can get applications for your iPad or for your, you know, Android phone to work as a remote control for your TV. So, hey, you don't need a remote control anymore. You've got this nice little device, and it can be a phone, and it can be a thing that takes pictures, and it can be a thing that allows you to share information. And now, well, it can control your TV as well. And you can start to see it being able to reach out and interact with other parts of the environment. It could tell you things about the air conditioning or the HVAC that's inside your building. It could tell you automatically, you know, where printers are and stuff floating around. It could interact with, you know, people's locations. And so we're starting to see little bits and pieces of all of these things. You know, Google had the Latitude service, which they're actually dropping. But, you know, so you could see where your friends were on a map. You turned it on, and you got your map, and it's like, oh, yeah, they're scattered around town here. And so I think that the one thing I think is going to be a really fascinating area is ubiquitous computing. But I don't have a good enough sense of those kind of things to be more specific than that, to say, you know, here's a business opportunity. Because if I did, I'd probably be doing it. And if I understood, you know, what companies were going to get blown out of existence by disruptive technologies, I'd probably be out shorting their stocks now or investing in the guys that were going to disrupt them. And sadly, I'm not doing any of those things, and it's because I lack the knowledge.
You know, Terry, maybe let's approach this question in another way. Why don't I throw out some concepts, and then you can choose, you know, two or three of them that you want to comment on. So the concepts are Judea Pearl's external validity work, D-Wave and quantum computing, Kurzweil in the singularity, and this whole thing called deep learning. So you choose one or more of those and just comment.
So quantum computing is fascinating. I mean, D-Wave is interesting. They're a Vancouver computing, very controversial about whether they're actually doing real quantum computing or not. So they have some people out in the academic community who are very strongly, not opposed to them, but who believe that they're not actually carrying out what would be called real quantum computing. I think it has some potential huge ramifications for computing overall if we actually do develop these kind of capabilities. But again, my knowledge is so scant that I have a hard time projecting in where this stuff is going to go in the future. It could be wild and wonderful, like anything to do with quantum mechanics. It is so counterintuitive to our normal human intuition that I think it's really difficult to project how that's going to unfold. The singularity is absolutely fascinating. I sort of tend to be, I guess, a believer in maybe the broad singularity principle, which I would say is related to Moore's law. We have watched computer hardware extend its capabilities at this exponential rate for a relatively long period of time. Now, people keep saying that Moore's law is going to end. People have said it in the past. The result has always been that clever people somewhere have figured out ways to keep moving forward, not necessarily always in the same direction. So, you know, there was a period of time when Moore's law was all about, you know, our frequencies are going to go up, our clocks are going to go up. So, you know, when I started working, I was working with an 8080 CPU that was running at 2 megahertz. And, you know, the next year or the year after that, it was 4 megahertz, and then it was 8 megahertz. And, you know, and now we're up into the gigahertz. But, you know, whatever it was 5 years ago or so, that flatlined. You know, we got to that kind of 3 to 5 gigahertz range, and we haven't moved out of it. And, you know, there was an initial feeling, well, that's it. That's the end. We're not going to be able to go faster anymore. But, you know, we've continued to be able to pack more transistors into a given amount of space. And the result is, even if we haven't been able to clock them any faster, we've been able to ship out, you know, now these multi-core processors. So there, instead of being a single core in their processors, 2, there's 4, there's 6, there's 8, there's 64. As a software developer, this has made life harder for us. I mean, whereas before we could just expect our software to run faster because the clock went up, we can't expect our software to run faster because there are multiple cores. So the hardware guys were doing a good job of being smart. Now the software guys have to be smart, because it's like, okay, how am I going to take my C# program and actually effectively make it run over 64 cores so that it runs 64 times faster than if it was running on one core? That's a hard problem. There is probably some opportunity for some disruption there in programming languages and tools and things like that, if somebody can actually figure out how to make that happen more or less automatically, because that's a tough problem for many developers right now. But going back to the singularity kind of thing, it's like, we continue along this exponential curve in terms of kind of processing power. Although it's the road is not necessarily a straight one, it has some funny curves in it that have required us to, you know, do different things. So we think we're reaching the limits of how small we can make the features on a piece of silicon, so how small we can make a transistor. But, you know, people are around the corner talking about, you know, stuff based on carbon nanotubes or based on other technologies. So I tend to think that, you know, those are going to pan out. I tend to be maybe, I don't know whether optimist is the right word, because some people wouldn't regard this as maybe necessarily being an optimistic path, but I tend to think we're going to be able to keep expanding that computational capability. So, you know, fundamentally, maybe, probably not all people believe this, but I mean, fundamentally, the brain is a computer. I mean, it's a computer that works in totally different ways than we do, or than sort of the kind of the computers that we deal with on our desktops and our mobile devices. But, you know, I guess maybe what I could say is that what the brain does can be modeled as computation. And so at some point, we will build enough processing power to be able to model that computation accurately. And that will require not just, of course, the actual raw horsepower to do so, but it will require the software to do so, and it will require the understanding of how the brain itself works to a certain extent in order to be able to model that accurately. But at the point that we do all of those things, we will have something that I would say, to all extents and purposes, is a brain. Well, what's that brain going to be like? I mean, that's a fascinating question. It's like, well, once you have the ability to model this thing to that degree of accuracy, how does it behave? Does it behave the way that we expect? The fact that it's perhaps completely disembodied, so that it doesn't have any sort of notion of sensory aspects of the world. I mean, so now we get into sort of more philosophical questions of, you know, is the nature of consciousness bound to its physical expression? And, you know, computers may actually answer these things for us by creating the artifacts that prove it one way or the other. So I think, I think that the singularity in the sense of I read singularity as being kind of the point where our computing power is sufficient that we can effectively model, emulate, execute something that is a parallel to our own kind of intellectual capability, our own intellectual processor, the brain. And when we get to that point, as I say, it's like, well, how does it behave? What does it do? And then there's a whole bunch of other interesting questions. It's like, well, is our programming, our intellectual model, transferable into this other form? Is there a way of taking Terry, as he's executing now in his wetware, and shifting him into this computing device? And if there is, you know, what's the difference between those two things? Assuming that the original Terry is still there running in his wetware, and you now have this other device that's actually running Terry as well, you know, what's the relationship between those two things? Another kind of weird, wonderful, fascinating philosophical scenario. And I guess I don't think that these things are ridiculously far off in the future. So it's like they will be incredibly disruptive. They will be disruptive beyond anything that I think has ever happened to humanity before this point in time. And it's probably not that far away. And by that I mean, you know, it may not be, I don't think it's going to be 10 years, might be 30 years. I'd be surprised if it wasn't by 100 years. Like, by 100 years from now, if we haven't done all this stuff, I would be surprised. I mean, I just, my suspicion is that there isn't anything that will stop us from doing that. So 100 years from now, which in the span of humanity is not much, and in the span of the planet Earth is absolutely nothing, in this tiny fraction of time, the world is going to turn upside down in some sense, because our whole notion of what it is to be conscious, to be a person, is likely to have been disrupted in ways that we're probably not prepared to deal with particularly well. But I'm excited about it. And being an optimist, it's like, man, I would love to live through to that time, because I would like to see what that is and know some of those things.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I guess some of the things that you talked about sort of ties in with this whole area of deep learning, which is sweeping some areas of academia. And then it's interesting that the University of California has published a paper in the journal Communications just recently, just a few weeks ago, providing support of quantum annealing in the D-Wave computer. So it looks like there's some support, research support. And then I guess this all ties in with some of Judea Pearl's earlier work, and then some of his later work as well, right? So it's an exciting time, and I'm sort of looking forward to seeing what happens. But you know what? I'm thinking it's going to be sooner, not later. It's not going to be 100 years. I think it's going to be less than that, much less than that. I'm down to the last two questions I'm going to ask, and this next one is about, you know, Terry, you're this global figure. You're highly respected. You're considered one of the top people in your area because of your breadth of experience and your deep academic background as well. You know, from all the speaking and travels and work, do you have any stories that you want to share? Maybe something amusing, unexpected, amazing, and so on?
We actually talked about this in the last interview, and you know what? I don't know whether there's been anything particularly interesting that's happened to me over the past year or so. You know, the past year has been more of one of just keeping things kind of moving along on the same pattern that they've been for the time before that. So, no, I can't think of anything. Sorry, Stephen.
And then my last question is a very open-ended one, and it's one that I always ask at the end of every interview, and I'm sort of turning the tables, and I'm saying, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Again, you know, I don't think I have a lot to say about this. You are particularly gifted at coming up with a really thorough set of questions for talking about stuff. And, you know, we've covered off talking today a much, I think, broader spectrum of things than we talked about in the past interview. And touched a lot more on things that are more kind of passions of mine as opposed to, and maybe a little bit more having to do with my opinions about stuff than on the kind of nitty-gritty details of software development that we spoke about last time. So, you know, I'm not sure. I probably wouldn't have suggested asking a question about the singularity. It wouldn't have occurred to me as something to ask. But it was an excellent question to ask, nonetheless, because as would be obvious from my kind of the amount of time I spent talking about it just a moment ago, it's like it does interest me, and I think it really is in some sense more fundamentally important than many other things that we've talked about inside software development. But like I say, I wouldn't have thought to ask that question, so I can't think of anything else that I would have thought to ask, and you've thought of things to ask that I wouldn't have contemplated, so.
Well, Terry, you triggered a lot of these additional questions in our dialogue just now, right? So I really enjoyed this time with you, and I've got this global figure, really highly respected, as I indicated earlier, and you took the time to share your experiences with the audience. So thank you for coming in today.
Thank you, Stephen. As usual, it was super interesting sitting down and chatting with you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Terry Cota, globally acclaimed entrepreneur, executive, and superb platform software architect and developer.